This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Just about every week, something happens that leads me to ask myself the same question. What planet am I on? I look at the news, I read the news, I look at my surroundings, and I just wonder, what in the world is going on? Why am I the only one scratching my head? Am I the only one that feels this way? Good morrow, everybody. Welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We got an action-packed show for you. You know, as I was promoting what was going to be on today's show, some people said to me, wow, that sounds like a great show for a change. Now, this person was joking. But I will tell you, if you're thinking of changing the channel or going to bed, no. I got news for you. This show is going to be one for the ages. For starters, next hour, John McAfee, dead in his jail cell. The cyber security guru. They claim he killed himself. I said from Jump Street, I didn't believe it. Well, apparently no one believes this. So we're going to talk with John McAfee's biographer next hour about getting an idea of what might have happened to him. And this country, I don't care whether you're Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, libertarian, independent, non-political, whatever, black, white, old, young, whatever. This country is very divided right now. So Nathan Bomey has a new book out with some strategies for how we can heal that division. I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. And we'll get into, in the 4 o'clock hour, a discussion of how nightlife and tourism is going to be critical to New York's comeback with Noel Ashman, the filmmaker and nightclub impresario. I didn't have nearly enough time to talk with him last week, so I invited him back today. And in preparation for this interview, we spent a lot of time confirming whether or not having him on Thursday meant having him on Friday morning or Thursday night. So ultimately, Friday morning or Thursday morning. Ultimately, we've been able to determine that it is, in fact, tonight or this morning. All right. But this press conference with Andrew Cuomo and Eric Adams was surreal. Let me hear a little bit of Governor Cuomo, if I can, at this press conference yesterday. This is actually Eric Adams at that press conference with Andrew Cuomo yesterday as they addressed the issue of gun violence.
I look forward to the partnership with this administration, as well as the partnership with Washington, D.C., to finally turn around the systemic poverty and crime that's pervasive in far too many communities in the city.
All right. Now, that's all very good. What was lacking in Governor Cuomo's comments and Eric Adams' comments was any discussion of how. Now, I think Governor Cuomo and Eric Adams both said a lot of the right things, but essentially it was just rhetoric. It really was very hollow, very meaningless. Now, Andrew Cuomo took the obligatory shot at his rival, Bill de Blasio, saying in words or substance, I know Bill de Blasio, obviously, and I know Eric Adams, and I think I'm going to work very well with Eric Adams. It was sort of a veiled shot, not so veiled shot, at Bill de Blasio, meaning I don't work well with the current guy. And this is what, and I will point out that after Bill de Blasio was elected, Andrew Cuomo said the exact same thing about Bill de Blasio. They said, the two of them did a press conference together saying that they were going to have the best working relationship that any governor and mayor had ever had. So we saw how well that worked out. But this is the thing with Eric Adams that I just can't wrap my head around. And I'm not, again, I want to clarify, Eric Adams has kind of won me over the last 8 years. I think he's been a much better borough president than I would have thought. Now, I had very low expectations for him. I thought he was going to be a total disaster as borough president. I worked to recruit his challenger against him. I didn't think he was too impressive as a state senator. I thought he lived right in that gray area of what's ethical, what's unethical. So I had very low expectations, but he has repeatedly done things over the course of the last 8 years that I've found pretty impressive. But the thing with Eric Adams that I just can't seem to wrap my head around. Now, look, everybody knows I'm for Curtis Sliwa. My cards are on the table. And I was with Curtis last night at the ballpark in Coney Island. And I'm going to give you some highlights of our experience in Coney Island last night, where Margo Katsimatidis threw out the first pitch at the Cyclones game. And she did a great job. It was a sight to behold. It was really a fun night. And I'm so glad that I went, and I'm so glad that I was invited. Big thank you to John Katsimatidis and the Katsimatidis family for inviting me. But the thing that I can't wrap my head around with Eric Adams is the guy is just all things to all people. He's acting like Andrew Cuomo's best friend. He's acting like Bill de Blasio's best friend. He's acting – and a great interview that Rita Cosby did with him last night, in which she really tried to drill down on the issue of whether or not he was going to try and hire more cops. I'm still waiting for him to answer that question. But he's all things to all people. He's the best friend of the voter that is concerned about rising crime. He's the best friend of the voter that's concerned about police misconduct. Now, those two issues are not necessarily in conflict. I just don't know how Eric Adams continues to thread this needle where he's all things to all people. Pretty soon he's going to have to actually answer some concrete questions about what he's going to do about things. But to me, the person that really took the cake at this press conference that they did in Brooklyn was not Eric Adams, and it wasn't even Andrew Cuomo. It was Assemblymember Diana Richardson. Now, you might remember Diana Richardson because when this show first started, I talked about her. She is somebody who had no problem. She was arrested 5 years ago for hitting her 12-year-old son with a broomstick and charged with assault, endangering the welfare of a child, criminal possession of a weapon. And she, of course, was pepper sprayed by the NYPD while marching at a demonstration over the murder of George Floyd. She is an interesting person, to say the least. I do have some respect for her. She actually got elected to the state assembly in a special election 6 years ago as a third party candidate, which is very rare. I think she might have been the first person since Melinda Katz to do that. But anyway, Diana Richardson had called for Andrew Cuomo to resign. And yet, over the sexual harassment issues, the Me Too scandals, what she described as his problems with trustworthiness and his ability to lead. Now, you can agree with what she said, or you can disagree with what she said. Fine. She's a politician. She called for another political leader to resign. And yet, she's at this press conference with Andrew Cuomo and Eric Adams, and she's acting like Andrew Cuomo's best friend. She's acting all lovey-dovey with him. And she's not just professional with him. She's warm. She's warm. She's kissing him on both cheeks. Now, I don't know about you, but if somebody that I worked with called publicly for me to resign, Molly, for instance, she's probably looking to get rid of me. If she were to call publicly for me to resign, I'm just joking. Molly's very supportive. If Molly or Christian were to publicly call for me to resign or be fired, not privately, publicly, and then were to come out with me at a press conference, I don't know what my attitude would be to them, but it would not be kissing them on both cheeks. And so Diana Richardson was asked about this by Julia Marsh, a reporter for the New York Post. And the reporter asked Assemblymember Richardson, I mean, what's the story here? This is what you said a couple of months ago. And now here you are with him now. Isn't this, at the very least, a little bit of hypocrisy? Here was the question from reporter Julia Marsh. Here was the answer from Diana Richardson.
Assemblywoman Richardson, just 4 months ago, you released a statement about the attorney general's probe into the governor over sexual harassment allegations, saying that he's not entitled to remain in the most powerful office in the state when, by his words and actions, he has irreparably damaged his trustworthiness and ability to lead, while the rest of us twist in the wind awaiting new and more disturbing allegations. So can you address why you're here with him today, given that statement?
I'm here today with the governor because politics is politics, business is business. And at the end of the day, we have a job to do to show up for the people of the great state of New York. With all due respect, ma'am, that question is inappropriate for the topic of this press conference. As you have heard eloquently put from my partners, as well as the governor, we are in a state of emergency. This is not the time for us to be in our emotions and people's personal endeavors. This is
personal
a time for
endeavors?
Us to be solution oriented and focused. And what I just said is the statement that Senator Myrie agrees with as well. Next question. Next question. And please, let me just say to the press that is in the room, if you are going to ask questions here today, please remain on topic, because we are talking about communities that are in pain. We are talking about gunshots that are ringing, and we want to remain on topic. We want to remain solution oriented. We don't want divisive questions. All right. That is going to take us off of the solution that we need to focus that is at hand.
And then
let me ask next.
She continues.
All right. We're going to take one more question.
So Cuomo walks up to the podium grinning ear to ear. And he's got a look on his face. First of all, I've never seen the guy happier, because he's happy that he's not the one lacing into the press corps for asking. They're not even difficult questions. They're questions for the first time. He's grinning ear to ear, and he's got a look with his hands are up, and he's saying, well, I'm not going to mess with her. Next question. He's loving it. First of all, I want to point out, nobody forced Assemblymember Richardson to call for the governor's resignation. She could have easily said what I said, which is the Attorney General Letitia James has appointed a special prosecutor to investigate the facts, and I'm going to wait until all the facts are in. That would have been a very sane and sober response. Instead, Assemblymember Richardson rushed to say that he should resign for untrustworthiness. Now, is she saying, now when she says now's not the time for, I don't even know what she said. Personal endeavors, politics. This is the time for business, not politics. Is she saying that she was just playing politics 4 months ago? If so, then her constituents should know that. That when she calls for something as serious as the governor to resign, it's not to be taken seriously. It's just politics. Now, I think there's nothing wrong with working with someone who you have a difference of opinion with politically. We're going to get into that with Nathan Bomey coming up in about 13 minutes. But for you to then, instead of just answering the question, lambast the reporter and say, I'm not going to answer any questions that are off topic. Well, you're in the wrong business then. I answer questions on Friday mornings on every topic. Now, if I can answer questions on any topic, why is Diana Richardson somehow unable or unwilling to answer questions? I mean, she's not willing to answer the question because what she's doing makes no sense. For her to be literally kissing the guy that she's trying to shove out of office and then somehow make it out to be the reporter's fault, I mean, crazy. And again, maybe this is off topic, Assemblymember Diana Richardson, Diana Richardson was arrested for hitting her 12-year-old son with a broomstick. She was charged with assault, endangering the welfare of a child, and criminal possession of a weapon, and menacing. That's the person that you just heard give a lecture to that reporter. Your reaction, 800-848-WABC, 800-848-9222. Well, I don't know if they can do much for being, if you're in pain because you've been beaten with a broomstick. But if you've got muscle aches, if you've got knee pain, if you've got neck pain, if you've got shoulder tendonitis or plantar fasciitis, then the good folks over at Trinity Rehab can help you. They will restore your freedom to live your life pain-free. It's not your father's physical therapy. It's cutting edge and it's state of the art. They have something called the EPAP machine. It's FDA-approved, non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing, and it gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for conditions like back pain or neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, everything that involves chronic pain. In just 3 5-minute sessions with the EPAP machine, you could be virtually pain-free. There's no prescription needed to get started. They're all over New Jersey. They're in Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, and Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab at 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977, or go to trinity-rehab.com.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
The great Johnny Cash, something that can bring this country together is the music of Johnny Cash, or really good music in general. We're going to discuss some of the divisions that are in this country right now. Some people are saying we as a country are more divided than at any time since the Civil War. We're going to get into that with Nathan Bomey, who has a new book out about bridge builders and how we can bring the country together. That's coming up in about 10 minutes. And then in the next hour, we're going to talk about the death of John McAfee. Does anybody still believe that he killed himself? I think that the resounding answer to that is no. But I do want to thank John and Margot Katsimatidis and the whole staff over at here at the radio station at WABC for inviting me to the WABC night we had at the Brooklyn Cyclones last night. Margot threw out the first pitch, and this was a pretty noteworthy day for the Katsimatidis and the New York baseball community, because it was announced yesterday morning that John Katsimatidis is actually going to be part of a consortium that is bringing an independent league team to Staten Island. Now, I try not to talk about Staten Island too much on this show, but it was a real kick in the gut to have the Staten Island Yankees basically leave Staten Island high and dry, and they have this beautiful ballpark. It does need some work, the ballpark, but it's got a beautiful view of Lower Manhattan. And John is part of a consortium, along with The Rock's ex-wife, that is bringing baseball back to Staten Island. So we were on hand at the ballpark in Coney Island, Mamamides Park. I love Coney Island. Other than maybe Atlantic City, it's one of the communities that means the most to me. And I spent 3 great years there working, and it was wonderful to be back. And it was really a dream come true. Todd Shapiro, who does publicity for us, got a lot of old Mets stars to come to be with Margot as she threw out the first pitch. Doc Gooden was there. Art Shamsky was there. And John Franco was there. And it's the coolest thing in the world to be able to interact with your sports heroes as if they're regular people. I never met Doc Gooden before. I've talked to him on the radio a couple times. But I got to spend some time with him. And he was as cool in real life as he as he comes across in other aspects of life. I told him I'd read his book. I told him what his career had meant to me, what his battles with addiction had meant to me in terms of inspiring me to meet my own challenges. And he was just the greatest guy in the world. And I really wanted to pin him down for his opinion on certain controversies that involved the 86 Mets and this and that. And I would say, you know, Doc, off the record, just between us, and Dominic Carter was with me most of the time, I'd say, Doc, just between us, what was your opinion, off the record, what was your opinion just on X? And he'd say, I don't care if it's on the record. I'll tell you my opinion. The guy was so cool. Peter King was there. It was great to hang out with him. Mayoral candidate Curtis Sliwa was there. And it was really a very special day at the ballpark in Coney Island. I got to see some of my old colleagues from when I worked for the Cyclones. And it really meant a lot to me for me to be there. The only detriment was my wife had to work, so she wasn't able to come with me. And I would have loved to have spent the evening with her there as well, because it's always such a magical experience whenever I get back to Coney Island and to get back to that ballpark. 800-848-9222. Talking about Diana Richardson, who went from calling for the governor to resign, calling for his head, to literally kissing him in this press conference with Eric Adams yesterday, which, as far as I could tell, look, here's a news flash. We've got a crime problem in this city, and we've got a gun violence problem in this country. That's all the governor and Eric Adams said. They really didn't come up with any sort of a plan of what they're going to do. I couldn't tell you. I read all the press clippings on it. It was not as if the governor said, all right, here's our 5-point plan. We're going to do this. That's a state initiative. We're going to do this. This is a city initiative. We need the city's buy-in for this. We're going to do this. This is a federal initiative, and we're going to do this. That's state, federal, and city. And then we need the private sector and the nonprofit sector to step up and do this. It was nothing like that. It was a dog and pony show. It was a way for Eric Adams to throw a bone to the voters and say, I'm tough on crime. It was a way for Andrew Cuomo to wrap his arms around Eric Adams and say, this is my guy. I'm with him. Given the Cuomo controversies, I'm not sure why Eric Adams would want Andrew Cuomo's support. Look, I know when you're the mayor, you have to work with whomever the governor is. Although that's a memo Bill de Blasio didn't seem to get these last 6 or 7 years. But I felt bad for anyone that was watching this and was taken in by it, because it was meaningless. It was complete political theater. 800-848-9222. Your calls are welcome. Your thoughts are welcome. Your questions. 800-848-WABC. Shirley is here in New York. Hello, Shirley.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you.
Good. So I just wanted to comment on that. I was listening to the Rita Cosby interview with Eric Adams, and what you were saying about this, what's her name, Denise Richardson?
Diana Richardson, yes.
Diana Richardson, okay. So it seems to me it's all politics. And, you know, when you gave her background about her getting into trouble with abusing her son, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
She's the type of person who is a hypocrite. And that's what jumps off to me about her. She wants to talk about Cuomo and what the sexual harassment allegations, and he should leave and so forth and so on. And then she turned around, and then she's going to try to tell the New York Post reporter off, which I found unprofessional on her behalf. It seems like she's the type of person that you cannot trust. And when it comes to Eric Adams, I'm leery of him. Simply because it seems as though he doesn't want to come out and say, well, yes, I will hire police officers, but I'll do it on the basis of looking to see where we're at. And the whole thing about taking cops out of the precinct who perform clerical duties. But here's the thing, when I do the math, I'm thinking, okay, so how many cops can you pull out of the precinct that do clerical duties? Is that going to fill the gap where you have officers who are continuing to leave, retire, maybe quit, or, you know, transfer to another police department out of state somewhere? And then he wants to say, well, you know, based on this, that, and the other, I'll do the analysis. You cannot get crime under control unless you have enough police officers.
Well, Shirley, you're so right. And the problem with police officers retiring and leaving and moving to other jurisdictions, that's indicative of another problem, which Eric Adams, in the press conference yesterday and in his interview with Rita last night, did nothing to address. And that is the morale crisis that's going on within the NYPD right now. The NYPD, the rank and file men and women of the NYPD, and I'm not disputing what Eric Adams said, that there are too many officers filling out paperwork. I actually think he's right about that. But the men and women of the NYPD that I talk to on a daily basis and that call this show, they don't feel as if One Police Plaza and City Hall have their back. So what you're seeing is not only police officers rush to retire or move to other jurisdictions, but you're seeing police officers who don't engage in proactive policing because they're afraid that they're going to be brought up before the Civilian Complaint Review Board, or they're afraid they may wind up indicted themselves. So unless there's a crime happening right in front of them, you don't see them in many instances, not everybody, you don't see them in many instances wanting to get involved in actual crime prevention. And until Eric Adams can do something about the morale problem that the police officers are facing, you're not going to do anything about the exodus of cops retiring.
That's true. I agree with you. And so that's why I say when I do the math, I'm just thinking, okay, well, you know, you're going to have officers that are just going to leave for whatever reason, and you have to fill that gap. And you have to be able to control a population of, you know, 7 million people or so in New York City. And with the amount of criminals that are out there and the crimes that are happening. And here's the other thing that I have a real problem with. You know, with Mario Cuomo, he was the one that signed in the no reform bill.
Right, Andrew,
So it just seems as though Eric Adams is cozying up to Cuomo. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, look, here's the problem. You're working with a governor who signed a bill reform law who's making it easy for criminals to go out there.
You're exactly right, Shirley. And we still don't know what Eric Adams' position really is on that bail reform law. Look, we know the solutions, right? The solution is give judges discretion to keep dangerous criminals in jail without bail. That's number one. That requires a change in the state law. Bring back the anti-crime unit. Eric Adams has already said he wants to do that, to his credit. Improving police morale. That is something that is easier said than done, right? There's probably many steps that are involved with that. Bringing back stop, question, and frisk as it was used 20 or 30 years ago. That's a big part of what we're dealing with here, so that you don't have people carrying illegal guns and their criminal cohorts carrying illegal guns. Broader use of ShotSpotter. And again, I couldn't understand. Rita Cosby gave him a layup last night in asking about this question. Hiring more police officers. President Biden is offering him the money. It is an issue that is tailor-made for the current crisis. And Eric Adams, I don't know if it's a reluctance to tick off what he perceives to be his base or something else going on here, but he won't say what everybody knows is obvious, which is when crime is going up, you need to do what Mayor Dinkins did, which is hire more cops. And unfortunately, Eric Adams won't do that, or at least he won't say that. I don't know what he's hiding. Hey, we're going to talk with Nathan Bomey next. He's got a terrific new book out about how we can build bridges in this country. It's no secret that this country is pretty divided. What is the first step? What is the last step in healing that divide? Nathan Bomey, who is a terrific journalist with USA Today, has some answers. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
Say, and it's so nice to hear you say.
it's so nice to be with you. Unfortunately, that's an attitude that is not nearly prevalent enough in this city. It's in this city, in this state, in this country, maybe even this world. I listen to some people that call this radio show or some people who comment on our Facebook group, and I listen to the way they describe their political adversaries. And they describe their political adversaries, people who happen to have different opinions than them, as if that they're folks that just burned their house down. And all I could think as I hear the most vile names thrown at not only public figures, but just anonymous people who you happen to disagree with. All I could think of is, do these folks not realize that we're all in this together? We're all neighbors. We're all Americans. Well, there's one book which seems to realize the severity of the situation, and one writer who seems to actually be willing to offer some solutions to healing this country's divides, political and otherwise. Nathan Bomey is a business reporter for USA Today and the author of the new book, Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. I'm just thrilled that he's made some time to join us at this odd hour. Nathan, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
It's a privilege to be with you.
No, the privilege is mine. So when we talk about polarization and division in America today, how bad is it from your perspective?
Well, it's so toxic that it is deadly. You know, we know during the pandemic, of course, that in some cases, because we hate each other, we are actually, you know, dying because we don't trust the vaccines, for example, or we don't trust the messages that we're receiving. And, you know, polarization, you know, it affects everybody. And, you know, the unwillingness to agree on the facts is certainly a part of this, but that's not all of it. And we see that, you know, people on the left, people on the right are subject to this vitriol that is directed toward both sides. And so I said to myself, I've got to go out and meet people who aren't accepting the status quo. You know, I got to go out and talk to people who are trying to bring people together despite their differences. And I think, you know, it's about finding solutions, like you said, because so often journalism is focused on conflict. And I understand that conflict is important. We're going to continue to cover that. But I also want to talk about solutions because, like you said, you know, we are stuck in this together, whether we like it or not.
The 1960s, it was certainly a turbulent decade in American history. We had protests, we had assassinations, we had riots over protests and assassinations. How does the era that we're living in now compare to, say, the 1960s?
Yeah, I think it is difficult to compare eras, and if only in the same way it's difficult to compare, you know, Michael Jordan's era with LeBron James's era. You know, it's such a different game, but it's like, yeah, I mean, I think we had polarizing times before. Certainly the Civil War was probably a more polarized time than today, but I think what we see in the data is that people feel more polarized than ever, and whether we are or not is the question, but perception is often reality. If you look at the data, though, the percentage of people, you know, Democrats who view Republicans as bigoted and the percentage of Republicans that view Democrats as spiteful is just astronomical. And it demonstrates how far we are divided, at least emotionally. But when you look at the issues, people actually tend to agree more than they realize. And that's what's so interesting is people don't realize there's more common ground there than they might actually think.
It's such a great point. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Nathan Bomey. He's a business reporter for USA Today, author of the new book, Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. The owner of our radio station, John Catsimatidis, he does a show on our station every night at 5. And one of the things I love about it is he puts together in the same room Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, people from all different walks of life, different professions, different personal histories, different ideologies. And I'm always amazed at when they get down to discussing problems and solutions, how much common ground these folks have on individual issues, which leads me to my next question. Why then, if we have so much in common as people, as humans, as Americans, why then is this country so divided right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's so many different factors you can point to, but I think, it's certainly toxic polarization goes back decades. There's all sorts of factors. But I would say more recently, social media has supercharged it, and I think that it's impossible to really have this conversation without showing how social media has taken it to a new extreme. But the example you just cited, I think, is really important. And it reflects the fact that, in this book, I found that, forming relationships between people who aren't like each other is a very basic and sounds like a simple thing, but it's actually the way that we can start to bridge these divides. Because when you start to, you get to know someone who is not like you, whether they pray differently, look differently, think differently, that's when you begin to appreciate your shared humanity. And, we don't have to eliminate conflict. Like, we can still disagree. In fact, we have to do that in this democracy if we're going to progress. But if we don't have a shared respect for each other's humanity and a shared understanding, then we won't be able to progress.
You mentioned social media, and I certainly think your analysis, as spelled out in the book and in this conversation, is spot on. I'm also wondering about the fragmentation of traditional media. 50 or 60 yeah. years ago, when we had three channels, everybody was watching Ed Sullivan on Sunday nights. They were essentially getting their news from the same place. They were getting their entertainment from the same place. They all started from the same frame of reference, which is that the sky was blue. Now that there's 9,000 different channels, you could fill your whole day with a media diet that just reinforces whatever you want to hear about the world. How much of a problem in terms of toxic polarization is the fragmentation of the media? Traditional media.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. I think we're immersed in a hyper personalization of the media, which allows you to basically avoid the sort of information that might actually disconfirm your beliefs. And if you are able to just completely avoid information that goes against what you believe, then eventually you think that the world is as you view it and as you want it to be. And you don't encounter facts that may actually introduce an opposing perspective. Yeah, I think when Walter Cronkite was the voice of American news, I think there was more of a general respect for shared facts. No, I don't. I want to be careful and say, that era was dominated by white men, and there was all kinds of mistakes made. It was not, I don't know that there was all sorts of mistakes, and it wasn't a perfect society. But the point is that now that we can all go find our chosen conspiracy theory in any corner of the internet or any corner of, say, cable news, and some of the more extreme aspects of cable news, that is leading to, again, more supercharging of this polarized atmosphere that we're in.
So you profile in the book different countercultural leaders who believe in the power of forging lasting connections to bring about change. Give us a couple of examples of the types of people that you profile in the book and why you chose to highlight them as bridge builders.
Yeah, bridge builders really are countercultural, and I'm glad you mentioned that word. I really believe that, because it is countercultural to say we're going to get to know people who aren't like us, and we're going to actually listen to them. And I think some of the people who reflect that are people like Bob Inglis, who is a former Republican congressman from South Carolina, who has become a very vocal advocate for the need to take action on climate change. And I interviewed Bob, and he's, says he's still a proud Republican, still a conservative Christian, but says, listen, I understand that we have to do something about climate change. He's trying to reach his fellow conservatives and using, in some cases, the language of the Bible to say, we can be stewards of the earth. It's not about worshiping the earth. It's about being a steward. He's using language that I think conservative Christians are more likely to understand and to identify with. And it's very simple things like that that can make a very big difference, I think, in building bridges among people who oftentimes are, building them internally, I should say, can actually be a really important thing. Because you don't always build a bridge to meet in the middle. You actually sometimes build it from one side to the other, or you may actually build it in sections. You may rehabilitate a bridge that's become dilapidated. There are connections in this country that in some cases we just need to refine. And I think, people like that are are key to making it happen.
So you gave an example, and if people just tune in, we're talking with Nathan Bomey. He's the author of the book Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. You gave an example of a conservative who might have a couple of positions that have fallen that are not necessarily considered within the framework of modern conservative orthodoxy. Can left wingers also build bridges with right wingers rather than conservatives who may have an aberrant view on one or two issues speaking to other conservatives? Can you have people that are on the left build bridges with people on the right? And how does that process begin?
Yeah, I certainly think you can. And I think, it's probably at least feels more difficult than ever. But I think that it starts with listening. And I know that's really difficult. Again, very countercultural, because really we live in a speak first, listen second culture, but bridge builders listen first and speak second, because they understand that if you show the other person that you actually do care about who they are and you care about their perspective, you understand that they have a point of view, then you can actually then get them to listen to you. That's what's so interesting about this, that bridge building can be a selfish activity. You can actually say, I have something I want to accomplish, but to accomplish it, I have to listen to you first. It doesn't mean that you're validating what the other person believes or thinks. You actually may completely disagree with them, but you know what? That doesn't mean that we don't listen to each other. And I'm not talking about hate and that sort of thing. We're not talking about extremism, but on the issues on which there's room for perspective, which I think are many of the issues, then we have to listen, because listen, democratic discourse, if we don't have it, then we're not going to actually achieve any sort of growth on the issues that plague us.
All right. So we have listening with an open mind. What else can either individuals or other leaders, be they business leaders, political leaders, media figures, nonprofit leaders, what else can people do in terms of solutions for building bridges? Aside from listening, give me a couple of other solutions.
I think you have to choose nuance over caricature. I think that's really essential, because bridge builders understand that you can't label people. And if you do that, you're putting them in a box. You're not faithful to their complexity as humans. And, when you label people, that just ends up, basically generating a counterproductive response. It actually ends up, driving more distance between you, and it's just not going to work for anybody. So I think that's one thing. But from a very practical perspective, I think one thing that we can and should do is start to actually think about, how do we orient our institutions, like our schools, our colleges, our community institutions, to bring people together who aren't like each other? Because I actually think that this is key. It's actually scientific too. There's a concept called contact theory that basically says that when people get to know someone who maybe looks different or thinks differently, just on a very personal level, they end up gaining more respect for that person. And I think you can start in a very non-political way. You may sort of try to form a bond around something very simple and small. For example, hey, I remember Happy Meal toys from the early 90s. Weren't they better? Like, they actually like held up, like, what are they giving out now? Like stickers or something? Like, okay, you can bond over something silly, and it actually sounds dumb, but it's a small way you actually say, oh, wait, I have a shared experience with you as a human. Now let's start to grow from there and talk about progressively more difficult things, until eventually we're maybe talking about stuff that really can actually change this country.
Finally, so we've spent a lot of time talking about political differences in this conversation. I'm wondering how much of the toxic polarization that we're seeing in the country cleaves alongside racial or gender lines. We've heard a lot about race over the course of the last couple of years, and it seems to me that some of the conversations that have been taking place on race over the last couple of years have actually served to exacerbate rather than heal racial tensions. How much of a problem are racial divisions in this country now, and how do we go about solving those?
Well, I think, obviously if I had all the answers there, I probably would not be just a lowly journalist, but I would say that I spent a lot of time for this book trying to understand and explore, basically situations in which people are bridging racial divides. They're pursuing racial reconciliation. I met a group like Coming to the Table, which is organizing events and discussions discussions on the legacy of slavery. I met people like the Charlottesville Clergy Collective, which is trying to bring together an interfaith group of ministers in Charlottesville, Virginia, to deal with, you know, the legacy of Jim Crow, of slavery, and of what happened in Charlottesville in 2017, the extremism and the violence that happened there. I talked to Alvin Edwards, who's the pastor of the Mount Zion African Baptist Church there, you know, a black man who's been dealing with all these things. I said to him, how do you maintain faith that people can change after all of this? He said to me, I have to believe that people can change, because if I don't believe that they can change, that's a belief that I can't change, and I can't accept that. And I thought that was such a dynamic way to look at it. He's looking at people, other people, not through the lens of who they are, but through the lens of who he is. And to me, that was really inspirational.
Well said. Thank you very much for the time, Nathan Bomey. I want to encourage people to check out your book. It's called Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. You can also read Nathan regularly in the pages of USA Today. Thank you for the time, Nathan.
Appreciate it. It means a lot.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone, oh Constantinople, still is Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just like it better that way.
Take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople.
They might be giants. One of my absolute favorites. Love this song. 800-848-WABC. It's funny, when I ran into my brother-in-law Sunday at a family function, we were talking about, I don't remember what we were talking about, but basically he said to my wife, he pointed at me and he said to my wife, well, if Frank moved to Istanbul to do his radio show, I mean, you'd go there with him, right? And then she said, I think if Frank did a radio show in Istanbul, he would be taken off the air pretty quickly. And I think that's absolutely right. Now, speaking of governments not necessarily letting the whole truth be out there, when it comes to sharing information on UFOs, a new survey shows most Americans think the government is hiding some details. Oh, yes. A new Hill-Harris X poll reveals 60% of registered voters believe the government is not providing all the information on its recent UFO report. On the other hand, 40% believe it's being honest with the findings. The report released last month disclosed over 140 UFO sightings, but was unclear on what they could be. I'll tell you, the only thing that surprises me about this report is that it was only 60%. I don't know what the other 40% were thinking. 800-848-WABC. Hey, next hour, we're going to get into the death of John McAfee. John McAfee supposedly killed himself in his jail cell. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. And so we're going to talk with McAfee's biographer and a guy that has known him pretty well over the last few years and spent a lot of time with him to find out what he thinks happened. And he apparently is at the nexus of a whole bunch of different conspiracy theories. So we're going to get into that a little bit next hour. But first, let me squeeze in a couple of calls here. 800-848-9222. Steve is in Manhattan. Hello, Steve.
Frank, what am I going to do? The news update here at 11:58. First of all, your interview with Nathan was Nixon Frostoni. This is what I got out of that press conference today. First of all, if the governor wants to do a major, you know, to make a major break in New York State primary, he should resign. Adams should get out of the race. And what I got out of this is Andrew Cuomo should quit politics, like I just said.
Should what?
Am I going to do the news? I think he should fly to Hollywood and he'd get $20 million a movie. Andrew could play the heavy in any movie, and Richardson's a total flake.
Thank you, Steve. 800-848-9222. Coming up next hour, we'll talk a little bit about the death of John McAfee and the generation that has the worst tippers. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Make sure you have your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. Good morrow, everyone. I'm Frank Morano. John McAfee supposedly killed himself in his jail cell. We'll get into that coming up in just a little while with one of his biographers, Mark Eglinton. And I am more and more interested in this case by the day, because the more that we hear about it, the more this case doesn't add up. And it is turning out to be a real big mystery. I mentioned last hour the great time that we had in Coney Island at the Cyclones game yesterday. Again, my thanks to John and Margot Katsimatidis for letting me tag along there. I did get to spend some time with former New York Met and New York Yankee star Doc Gooden, and he was kind enough to take a photograph with me. If you want to see that photograph, I've posted it to my Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan. I told him, Doc, you know, as a Met fan, it just kills me that your first no-hitter was as a Yankee. And then he said, well, that's true, but it's not really true. And then he talked about this no-hitter that he believed he pitched back in 1984 in his rookie year, but the official scorer gave somebody he scored it a hit when it shouldn't have been a hit. He believed it should have been an error. So it was interesting to have that discussion with the man himself. Now,
did you get to ask Doc about the ESPN 30 for 30 that's coming out soon?
I did not get to ask him about that. No, we covered a lot of other ground, though. Believe me. After a while, I kind of felt like I was monopolizing his time for a bit. I'm asking him about Lenny Dykstra and Daryl Strawberry and Ron Darling and playing for the Mets in their world championship year and the Yankees. So I kind of had to let him go at some point.
Fair enough.
But it was an interesting experience nonetheless. Now, I will tell you, one of the issues that we've covered at length on this show is the issue of tipping. Now, if you think about tipping, it is a uniquely, in some respects, uniquely American phenomenon. You have a situation where you buy something or you pay for a service, and that's not the cost if it's certain services. Some services you have to pay a little more. It's expected. Somebody goes the extra mile. Actually, no. You're expected to tip no matter what. It's baked in. Certain people get tipped. Other people don't get tipped. So I was fascinated in seeing this new study conducted by CreditCard.com, which found that Americans' tipping habits had not improved much, if at all, during the pandemic, at a time when workers and businesses were severely struggling. Now, this does not seem to jive with some of the previous data on this, but here's the part about it that I found most interesting. The younger generation was found to be the worst culprit, specifically millennials ages 25 to 40 and Generation Zers ages 18 to 24, who were both found to be the worst tippers. Tipping is, of course, a common practice among most Americans, and it's expected, quite frankly. You don't tip at a restaurant and they're going to talk about you. They're going to ask, hey, did I do something wrong? Especially if you're in a sit-down restaurant, The average tip for a sit-down restaurant, according to this survey, is 20% of the bill. But it usually varies among different generations and what type of service it is. In terms of sit-down restaurants, 75% of respondents said they always leave a tip versus 5% who said they never tip, but the amount they tip differs. Over 75% of sit-down restaurant goers were found to tip less than 20% for reasons such as unfriendly staff, long wait times, and receiving the wrong order. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, if you read Life's Little Instruction Book, it says even if you get very poor service, you always have to leave a tip, even if it's a little tip, because this way people will know, the server will know, you didn't forget to tip. You're making a statement about the quality of service. So the study also found that there's a strong correlation between income and how much people tip. Almost 85% of higher income households with an annual household income of over $80,000 who go to sit-down restaurants were found to always tip. On the other hand, only 77% of middle income households with an annual income between $40,000 and $80,000 were found to tip. And only 65% of lower income households who make less than $40,000 annually leave a tip. So the interesting thing to me is the age disparity. Compared to their elders, younger generations generally have less money, which makes sense why they tip less. Not only were they found to tip less at sit-down restaurants, but also for food delivery, people or servers when picking up takeout, baristas, rideshare, taxi drivers, hairstylists, you name it. So my question for you is this, at 800-848-WABC, that's 800-848-9222, is we're eventually these young people, the Generation Zers and the Millennials, are going to be running the world. They're going to take over the world. So is the fact that they tip less than everybody else, is that an indication that eventually tipping, as a matter of course, will go the way of the dodo bird? Will tipping one day, maybe 10 years from now, maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years, will tipping become obsolete one day in this society? Or will these people that are not tipping now, once they start earning a little bit more money, will they then start tipping their standard 20%? And will these Generation Zers or Millennials get with the program? I'm curious what you've observed from young people in terms of tipping, specifically anybody listening that's in the service industry. Do young people tend to tip less in your view? And is that a reflection of their mentality that the price should be baked in? Or is that a reflection of them not having as much money as older folks? 800-848-WABC, because it is interesting. We've chronicled this before. Older people are the people that tend to have all the money right now. And that's why, you know, sometimes people will get on me because our radio show has a little bit of an older demographic. You know what I say? Good. Those are the people with money. Those are the people that I want to appeal to. Those are the people that I want to have the high ratings with. The people that have money. This addiction that certain media personalities have to younger demos, I don't understand it. I've never understood it. Give me the old folks. Give me the folks with money. 800-848-WABC. Your thoughts on this data, which shows young people are not tipping. Millennials aren't tipping. Generation Zers aren't tipping. 800-848-9222. I am always reminded of this scene, which I have edited because I had to remove the profanity, from the film Reservoir Dogs.
I'll take care of the check. You guys can get the tip. Should be about $1 apiece.
All right, everybody cough up some green for the little lady. Come on, throw in $1.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in tipping?
You know what these chicks make? Don't give me that. She don't make enough money, she can quit.
Let me just get this straight. You don't ever tip, huh?
I don't tip because society says I have to. All right, I mean, I'll tip if somebody really deserves a tip. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. But, I mean, it's tipping automatically. It's for the birds. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're just doing their job.
Hey, this girl was nice.
She was okay. I mean, she wasn't anything special.
What's special?
Look, I ordered coffee, right? Now, we've been here a long time. She's only filled my cup 3 times. I mean, when I order coffee, I want it filled 6 times.
6 times? Well, you know, what if she's too busy?
Words too busy shouldn't be in a waitress's vocabulary.
Excuse me, Mr. Pink, but the last thing you need is another cup of coffee.
I mean, these ladies aren't starving to death. They make minimum wage. You know, I used to work minimum wage, and when I did, I wasn't lucky enough to have a job the society deemed tip-worthy.
You don't care? They'd count on your tips to live?
You know what this is? It's the world's smallest violin playing just for the waitresses.
You don't have any idea what you're talking about. This is a hard job.
So is working at McDonald's, but you don't feel the need to tip them, do you? Well, why not? They're serving you food. But no, society says, don't tip these guys over here, but tip these guys over here.
Waitressing is the number one occupation for female non-college graduates in this country. It's the one job basically any woman can get and make a living on. The reason is because of their tips.
I mean, I'm very sorry the government taxes their tips. That ain't my fault. I mean, if you show me a piece of paper that says the government shouldn't do that, I'll sign it. Put it to a vote, I'll vote for it. But what I won't do is play ball. And it's not in college what you're giving me. I got 2 words for that. Learn to type. Because if you're expecting me to help out with the rent, you're in for a big surprise.
Just convince me. Give me my dollar back.
Hey, leave the dollars there.
All right, Ramblers, let's get rambling. Wait a minute. Who didn't throw in?
Mr. Pink.
Mr. Pink? Why not?
You don't tip.
You don't tip? What do you mean you don't tip?
They don't believe in it.
Shut up. What do you mean you don't believe in it? Come on, you. Cough up a bucket, cheap bastard. I pay for your breakfast.
All right, since you pay for the breakfast, I'll put in. But normally, I would never do this.
Never mind what you normally would do. Just cough in your butt like everybody else. Thank you.
800-848-WABC. Tommy is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Tommy.
How are you? Have you tried that menthol tip I gave you about?
Yeah, I've been taking the menthol cough drops. I have.
Yeah, they trick the body into thinking there's nothing to cough. Anyway, yeah. I'm going to tell you a quick story. I went to Dallas BBQ years ago, and it was just myself and another person, and they handed me a bill, and they included the tip. And I thought that curious, because usually they do that when there's parties of five
right.
and more.
Exactly.
Okay. So I went up to the waiter. I said, and, you know, during the pandemic, this was not this pandemic. I'll on a $15 bill, I'll leave $20. That's a 30% tip. I feel funny leaving $3. So I said, why did you include the tip when there's only two people? He looked to his left. He looked to his right. He took his fingers and he rubbed his forearm. He was making a statement about the racial makeup of the people in the restaurant.
You're kidding.
And that they don't tip. Now, the same people that are getting those $9 drinks with the umbrellas in them, I'm not one of them, are the same people that are stiffing the waiters. But in defense of my black brothers and sisters, many years ago when I drove cabs in Mount Vernon and I'd pick people up at the last stop on Dyer Avenue and drive them up to homes, the nicest guys, if it was a dollar fare, I'm talking 1972, a short trip was a buck, the guy was a sky cap at the airport, he'd always throw me a buck. A lot of the West Indian guys who worked late, who had homes in Mount Vernon, would throw me a nice tip. So
what can we read from your experience, Tommy, about what this data says about young people and tipping? Have you noticed a correlation between age and likelihood of tipping?
You know, the first thing that came to mind when you said that, a lot of the lefties are more to the, I'm sorry, a lot of the young millennials are more to the left than the older people. The older people with family and property, they don't want high taxes. They don't want all these social service safety nets that are gouging us and we're leaving the state. So just like Bill Clinton, who donated his underwear for a tax write-off to Salvation Army. You see, the lefties don't tip. The liberals don't tip. It's everything about the government. They don't believe in going to the church and going to the community and depending on tips.
Well,
I think that might be it.
I haven't seen any data which supports what you're saying that says that people tip along political lines, that conservatives tip more than liberals. I'm not saying what you're saying isn't true. I'm saying I haven't seen that. From any data anywhere. And anecdotally, I don't know that that's true either. My friends and family that are progressive, they tip just as much, if not more, than my friends and family that are conservative. 800-848-WABC. Rosemary is in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi, can I say two things before you cut me off? I'll try to be real fast.
Sure.
First of all, thanks for playing Tarantino. Nobody writes like him. He's
That's for
spooky.
Sure. You're right.
As my mother would, I would quote my mother, she would say, he's different.
That's true.
Number two, as we get older, I think not everybody, some people are genetically tightwads, but as we get older, most people see about hard work and have some more compassion if they have a little extra money. Plus, it's wise. You might run into these people again and you want good service. So it's a good idea to try to leave a better tip. And like I said, hard work and compassion for what they do. And if you can do it, then you do it. As you get older, you understand more and you have more of a heart. That's all. Thank you.
Well, I agree with you, Rosemary. Thank you. So what she's saying is I think a lot of the reason that young people tend to tip less is just because they have less money. I think that's a lot of what you're seeing. But Rosemary's saying it has less to do with their financial situation and more to do with an empathy they develop as they get older. I have to tell you, it's something that I had not considered, but which does seem to make sense to me. Leo is in Manhattan. Hello, Leo.
How are you doing? I am a starving artist who got so much in the debt during the COVID that I'm working now 7 days a week, 20 hours a day as a DoorDash on Manhattan from Battery Park all the way to Harlem.
Really? So what have you noticed in terms of tipping?
Number one, I wanted to say, as a joke, sometimes when I'm really pissed off, like I have to walk up six flights without elevator and not having dollar tip over my shoulder, I throw "Bada Bing, Mr. Pink," exactly from the movie.
That's funny. That's very funny.
But, I really, in last 6 months when I'm working on Manhattan, really 7 days a week, there is a racial line. Over 96th Street up, when I go, I know there is a for sure either way no tip or dollar tip, dollar 25. There is even such a trick that they, if there is a, you know, there's a lot of buildings without no, with no elevators, they put in the comment in the app of DoorDash, they put comment, I tip cash when you bring it upstairs. And then you go upstairs and they just grab it and you just cannot refuse to give it to them.
Wait, you're kidding. So they actually lie on the app about whether they're going to tip or not?
They close you.
Oh, that is outrageous. That is. Now, let me ask you, Leo, I know you were mentioning the racial disparity, but have you noticed that being pronounced among different age groups? Is that something that mainly younger people will do?
Honestly, majority of the people up from the how should I call it on the radio, low-income housings are young people. The older people, they don't order from Manhattan. I don't know what is the reason, but majority of the customers I got to bring from Manhattan up because there's different dashing area. I dash in Manhattan.
Interesting.
But if somebody orders from Harlem, food from Manhattan, I got to bring it up there and deal with that.
Wow.
And it's really... I use my middle name because I don't want to be approached from some customer. From my first name, you can recognize that I am most probably 99% chance that I'm white Caucasian. And I got to tell you, some of these customers really let me feel this way. We was for years in a slavery, or our grandparents, and you are now my servant, so you're going to bring it to me. I'm not going to tip you. And if you're not going to be nice, I'm going to give you a bad rating in the app, which reflects on my payment.
Wow.
I've got to be nice to anybody, no matter how they're treating me. Really, I'm not racist, but this is really my 6 months of daily dealing with the line between the Harlem and between Manhattan.
Interesting. Leo, thank you for the call. 800-848-9222. I'll continue with your calls in just a minute, and then we'll chat a little bit about John McAfee. Did he kill himself or not? What do you think? I do want to tell you a little bit about Trinity Rehab. If you go to Trinity Rehab, you don't have to worry about tipping. You only have to worry about getting better. If you're in chronic pain, whatever that pain is, shoulder tendonitis, tennis elbow, neck pain, back pain, knee pain, whatever the case is, They have something called the EPAP machine, which is going to bring you some relief. This is an FDA-approved, non-surgical, acoustic pressure wave technology similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue and it enhances healing. There's no prescription needed to get started. They're all over New Jersey, Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, and Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab today. Why suffer from pain when you don't have to? 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. You could also go to the website trinity-rehab.com. Before you turn to surgery, before you turn to prescription pain medication, try Trinity Rehab. 800-518-0977.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Talking a little bit about tipping, we're going to talk about John McAfee in just a minute and whether or not he killed himself. Also, some more highlights from my trip to Coney Island as we were all out there to support Margot Katsimatidis as she threw out the first pitch at the Cyclones game. I am reminded, listening to now two callers talk about the racial disparities with tipping, I am reminded of this scene from the film Crash, where you have two black men, younger black men, who are leaving a restaurant and the subject of tipping comes up.
Did you see any white people in there waiting an hour and 32 minutes for a plate of spaghetti? Huh? And how many cups of coffee did we get?
You don't drink coffee and I didn't want any.
Man, that woman in there poured cup after cup to every single white person around us. But did she even ask you if you wanted any?
We didn't get any coffee that you didn't want and I didn't order. And that's evidence of racial discrimination. Did you notice that our waitress was black?
And black women don't think in stereotypes? You tell me something, man. When was the last time you met one who didn't think she knew everything about your little lazy ass before you even opened your mouth? Huh? That waitress sized us up in 2 seconds. We're black and black people don't tip. So she wasn't going to waste her time? Now, somebody like that, nothing you could do to change their mind.
Oh, well, how much is you leaving?
You expect me to pay for that kind of service?
All right, 800-848-9222, if you want to call in. We had some young people calling in to defend themselves on tipping, but apparently they were intimidated by the radio authorities, and they've thought better of it. So let's say hello to Mark in Westchester. Hello, Mark.
Yes, sir. This is Mark, the former guardian angel, on a non-guardian angel-related issue about tipping. My father used to bring me to restaurants in New York City, and he told me TIP was an acronym to ensure
promptness. Right.
Correct. Proper service. So the maitre d' would get a sawbuck in his hand as a hello. My father would tip the waiter at least the same thing, a sawbuck as a hello. So we get a little extra attention and then tip at the end of the dinner. So tipping is important for the working gal or man. It's the way they made their living back in the old days.
Well, you're exactly right. I guess I don't know that that necessarily gets us any further in exploring whether or not this is a generational thing, Mark. Do you think that...
It is, sir.
So you think it is? You think young people just don't tip?
Young people have a little bit of a sense of entitlement. So unless you give them like a shoulder massage and a haircut tip and you have a beautiful girl behind the bar mesmerizing them, they don't think about the working person. They think that person is making $400 or $500 a night.
It's interesting. I think I'd go over 20% for that shoulder massage. Thank you, Mark. 800-848-9222.
I think most people would, Frank, in fairness.
Now, Christian, you've been very open about your tipping habits in the past. But now, Molly, you've said you're 23. Does that make you millennial or Gen Z?
I identify more with the Gen Z crowd.
Okay. Now, how? What are your tipping habits like, if you don't mind me asking?
Gratuitous.
Oh, really? So you tip, you're very generous with your tipping.
Although, before I was in the radio industry, and actually during my time in the radio industry, too, I've worked in many restaurants, so I've been on the other side.
Got it. Yeah, I've always felt that radio should be a medium where people are tipped. You know, I would love it. You know, I was at the Cyclones game yesterday, and I met a lot of people that listen on a nightly basis, a lot of very high-profile people, too. And they're giving me all sorts of great compliments. Oh, I love the interview that you did with this, or I love the approach that you took with that. Heshi from Maimonides Hospital gave me some of the nicest comments about my analysis of politics or of radio. I think it would be so nice if while they were shaking my hand and giving me a compliment, there was $5 in there. Hey, I enjoyed your commentary about Andrew Cuomo. Here's $5. I think that would be so nice. But for some reason, society has decided that radio is not a sector that requires tipping. No, some people might say the tip is don't go into radio. 800-848-9222. John McAfee, murder or suicide? We'll explore it next. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert, and we're listening.
John McAfee, most of you know him as the namesake of this antivirus software that pops up on your computer screen. Those of you that are into Bitcoin might know him from his commentary on cryptocurrency. Those of you like me who follow minor party politics might remember him from his attempts to win the Libertarian nomination for president. But recently, the reason he's been in the headlines is first, for being charged with a crime. And now, for dying. He died inside a Spanish prison. And the more that we learn about this death, the less it seems to make sense. Well, somebody that knew John McAfee as well as anyone is Mark Eglinton, who is a best-selling Scottish author and the author of the soon-to-be-released book, No Domain, The McAfee Tapes. Mark, it is great to talk with you again. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, great to talk to you again, Frank. Thanks very much, and good morning, everyone.
So, who, for people that haven't been following this story, let's catch them up. Who is or who was John McAfee?
Yeah, John McAfee was many things. You said it correctly in your intro. Some people know him as the McAfee Associates, McAfee antivirus founder. Other people know him as a guy who went down to Belize in the 2012-2013 era, a little bit before then, and got himself into some trouble with the locals. Other people know him as a guy who's out there railing against the U.S. Government, talking about cryptocurrency and how not to pay tax. I think that the thing with John McAfee is that he was many things, all of them at once, and I got to experience all of that in the period of time that I spoke to him.
How did you come to work with him?
Well, just by background, this is what I do. I'm a ghostwriter. I work with people on autobiographies, and that extends to sport, music, all kinds of things. People that are interesting, I want to talk to. So we connected on Twitter. I sent him a direct message. He replied. He abused me a couple of times. I thought about quitting and saying, forget it, it's a waste of time. Eventually, he sent me another message that said, send me some links to your work if you want me to ever reply again by email. Gave me an email address and sent him some work. And he said, you're the guy. And he said, I want to talk to you in a week. And at that time, I was out on a road trip with my wife somewhere. And we exchanged Skype IDs. And not a week later, in fact, an hour later, as I was driving along the freeway, John McAfee called me on my Skype app. So I had literally had to pull off the freeway and sit and talk to him at a gas station. And that was where it all began.
And what would you do when you said he abused you a couple of times? How so?
Well, I just got the impression that he was pretty angry, pretty irritable. His language was sort of reasonably forceful. I got the impression that he'd been approached about this kind of idea before, and I think he was concerned that people were trying to take advantage of him. And he said, you know, how much is it going to cost me and all that kind of thing. And I just disarmed him. I said, it's not going to cost you anything. You know, we're just going to get this done. I think I'm the right guy. I think I can understand you. Give me the opportunity and I'll prove to you that I can do it. And that's how it went. And I think once I got him on side, which I did very quickly, we had a really good relationship.
Now, this book that you're coming out with now called No Domain, the McAfee Tapes, that's not technically an autobiography, right? How did what began as a collaboration on an autobiography turn into this book, No Domain?
I'll explain that. Yeah. So this was going to be his autobiography. And we got it down the line to the point where we were approaching publishers and getting a lot of interest, to the point where we had deals to sign. And at that point, he surprised me and said, okay, great, but payment only by cryptocurrency. And I said, I don't think this is going to happen. Publishing is open-minded, et cetera, but they do not pay in cryptocurrency. So we're going to have a problem there. And the other problem was, obviously, there had to be a contract sent and signed. This was a guy who was in hiding. I said, is there anywhere that we're going to be able to send something that you can sign? He said, no. And I said, so what do we do? And he said, well, do not force me on this. And if you do, I'm afraid our relationship is over in terms of what we do with this book. So at that point, I had to walk away very reluctantly with all these hours of tape. And my relationship with him a little frosty at that point in time. So I developed a conversation with a publisher who'd been interested and said, listen, we have all this material. Could we turn it round into a conversation between John and I? Use this material, allow me to guide the conversations with narrative and make it something else. And to be honest, he was a bit sort of reluctant about it at the time. He thought, well, I don't know if this will work, but let's give it a go. So we did it. I did a contract myself. And halfway through, I decided I needed to ask John if it was okay if I did this. So I sent him a message in our usual medium, which was Skype Messenger. Said, listen, you know, I'm really sorry it didn't work out. Love the talks. I want to get your story out there. Are you supportive of me doing it this way? And he said, absolutely. Just do it. And I said, if you don't mind confirming an email, send me an email. And he said, yep, go ahead and use the material for a book about my life. So that's where we got to. And my last communication with him was through his wife while he was in prison, where he said, going to support the book 100% when it comes out. Can't wait to read it. And our relationship is back to good, or it was when we last spoke.
Wow. We're talking with Mark Eglinton. He's the author of the book No Domain, the McAfee Tapes. Why was he so bullish on cryptocurrency? Why would he only want to be paid in cryptocurrency?
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes down to him being in on the run and in hiding. I just think he said, listen, I haven't used a bank account in 5 years. I only deal in cryptocurrency. He was very, very guarded when it came to finances. And, you know, given the charges against him regarding tax fraud, which are a bit vague, I always thought that was an issue with him. And I completely respected that. And to be honest, if a publisher had been into the idea of working with cryptocurrency, I would have done it. But we're 5 years behind that in terms of the publishing. It's saying, I think we'll get there, but we're not there yet. But that's why it was for John. I think he just couldn't have any of his financial transactions visible.
Now, when you talk about him being in hiding, and I began the conversation with a discussion of him being in prison in Spain, what exactly were the charges that he was facing, be they charges from the United States government or other governmental entities? What was he charged with?
Well, there's two separate things. Well, you know, broadly, let's separate them. One was a grand jury had been convened in 2000, 2018, early 2019, for non-filing of tax returns for a period of time in the U.S. Not non-payment of tax, just non-filing of returns. That was the major charge. The secondary one was an erroneous charge regarding what they call pump and dump for cryptocurrency. I tend to ignore that. It's just an absolute red herring as far as I'm concerned. But the primary charge for which he was arrested in Spain was the tax fraud charges in the U.S.
So his widow, Janice McAfee, she, after John died, she talked a little bit about the charges that he was facing. This is what she said.
I blame the U.S. authorities for this tragedy. Because of these politically motivated charges against him, my husband is now dead. His last words to me were, "I love you. And I will call you in the evening." He did not deserve to die in a filthy prison like a caged animal. We had a plan. He had hope that things would work out, you know. We knew that there would be an uphill battle to continue to fight this situation. But he's a fighter. He's always a fighter. And anybody that knows John, that knows him even a little bit, knows that about him. He would never quit this way. He would never take his life in this way.
The thing that, that I found interesting from the get-go, Mark, was that generally the people that are most able, far too often in this country, to get a fair trial are people that have the money to hire very good lawyers, very good investigators, and mount a vibrant defense. I'm curious, yeah. Obviously, you know, you're not an investigator, you're not in law enforcement, but based on your analysis of the charges, do you think that McAfee could have had a fighting chance of beating the charges, or was he dead to rights in terms of conviction?
100% had a chance. I mean, let's be clear here. None of this extradition stuff was unexpected. I think the press made out that John's reaction to this news was what might have prompted what they thought might be suicide. I just don't buy that at all, because they knew the extradition would happen. They had plans to go to the Court of Human Rights. They had UK lawyers involved, given John was a dual citizen. This was all part of the plan, and the reality was that he wouldn't have been extradited from Spain anytime soon. It would have been a year at least. And the maximum penalty for what, I mean, 7 of the 10 charges he was charged with were dropped. So he was left with 3, and the likelihood was that it could have just been 5 years in prison in the U.S. if it even got to that. So, I mean, I just don't buy the whole idea that this was such a severe situation that this could have forced a situation where he committed suicide. I just don't buy that.
His widow clearly did not believe that he committed suicide, is what she said.
From what they said, he was an exemplary prisoner, of course. You know, he wasn't a troublemaker. He had a lot of friends here. They called him Papa America. and he always said they looked after him. You know, the prisoners sort of felt very protective of him, you know, in a grandfatherly way. I didn't believe he did this. And I will get answers. I want answers of how this was able to happen.
Based on your conversations with him over the years, irrespective of these particular charges, did he strike you as the kind of guy that could make maybe a rash decision and commit suicide?
No. John was the opposite to that. John was very calculating and he thought everything through. He had a mind that worked like no one else that I've ever experienced. Everything was mathematical. Everything was applied theory. As I've said before in the brief segment we did before, John had a hugely powerful life force, even at the age of 74. He'd spent his life evading problems, getting out of tough situations. It just does not make any sense to me that this would happen, based on my relationship with him. Now, offset that with the possibility that 8 months in prison in Spain might have been getting to him a little bit. Some of his tweets suggested that might have been the case. I still don't see it as the situation that it's being presented.
That's what strikes me as so odd. And if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Mark Eglinton. His new book is No Domain, The McAfee Tapes. It is available for pre-order on Amazon or wherever you get your books. He apparently tweeted preemptively that if he ever ended up dead and they said it was a suicide, that it wouldn't be a suicide. And he also got a tattoo, which seemed to back up that that assertion. Is it possible that McAfee, a guy that does seem to have enjoyed pulling the leg of society and of a lot of different people over the years, had this in mind, that he would say that if he's ever dead, it's not a suicide, and then as sort of one last laugh to commit suicide and leave people like us scratching our heads and wondering?
Not impossible. That's a, that's an excellent point. John, you know, self-confessed king of misinformation. He thrived on confusing people. He thrived on sort of operating in the gray areas of life. He enjoyed doing that. That was something he always enjoyed. Did he do this sort of last extreme move to kind of have one over on humanity as he left the world? I really don't know. But all I would say from my interactions with John is that he did enjoy, as you say, poking fun at the world. And this would be the ultimate way of doing it.
I read somewhere that even though he invented this antivirus software, that he really didn't use stuff like antivirus software much. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, John didn't use computers very much or cell phones or anything like that. I think the thing to say about McAfee Antivirus as the company and his role in it was that he really didn't want to ever be part of that. That was an accident. This kind of happened because he was at the forefront of programming at a time when viruses appeared. He found himself in his living room in Santa Clara as this guy who was at the forefront of this battle. But once he got into the sort of corporate world, which he wanted no part of, he just walked away from all of that. That just wasn't his life at all. John was somebody who wanted to live, not be a sort of corporate fat cat in boardrooms and stuff like that. So it wouldn't surprise me if he never used the product. I mean, by way of example, he wrote 4 books on yoga in the sort of 2000s and completely trashed them all publicly. So that wouldn't surprise me that John took that attitude to his own product.
That's wild. And just so folks understand what his socioeconomic status was exactly, what was his net worth? Do we have any idea?
I think he was broke.
He was broke?
I think so.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yep, I do. I genuinely do. People say, oh, John McAfee must have had money lying around somewhere. I think he did at some points in the last few years. I think he got to the point where his relationships with people were so risky and people were so averse to perhaps working with him that the well had run dry. I genuinely do. And I think this is the kind of sadness in it all, because we talked about a fee for me to do some of the writing work, and he did pay me a small fee, but I think it was very difficult for him to find that. And I think these illusions that people have about how much money John McAfee had in 2019, 20, 21 are vastly overstated. I think he was close to the wire.
Interesting. He did an interview with Larry King on his show back in 2016 when he was seeking the Libertarian nomination for president. And he talked a little bit about why he felt that he was uniquely suited to be president. This was John McAfee 5 years ago.
Why do you want to run for president?
Because, sir, the greatest problem facing America today is cyber war. It is on the horizon, Larry. Already, 2 teenagers took out the entire country of Ukraine's power for one day using a 25-year-old piece of software with 17 lines of code. Can you imagine, sir, what the Chinese can do to us? They have the capability now to completely disrupt our electrical power supply permanently. And what does that mean? No communications, no food delivery, no production of all of our necessities. A report to Congress last year said that 90% of the American population would perish in a cyber war with China. And you tell me who is running today who can fix this problem.
He did bring up the issue of cybersecurity, which has turned out to be a pretty important issue these days, as we've seen with these ransomware attacks and so forth. Why do you think his candidacies for president didn't generate more interest, even within the Libertarian Party? Usually third parties, they flock to controversial celebrities because it means name recognition. He wasn't even able to get the Libertarian nomination. Why do you think that was the case?
I think John's polarizing. First of all, let's just say that he told me that these two presidential runs, in inverted commas, were just for fun. He knew that he was never going to be president, etc., and he just did it for fun, quite literally. But in terms of his nomination, I just think he's polarizing. For every person that thinks that John McAfee is a sort of savior and a hero, and for all the hacking community, ironically, he is a hero, given that he spent the early part of his career battling them. There is another half of people who think he's just a nut. People who've seen the documentary about his time in Belize who think, well, regardless of how much of a pioneer he was in the tech world, he's somebody that might have murdered somebody, who might have done a lot of drugs, and they just couldn't take him seriously. So I think you've always got that problem with John McAfee. I think he's very polarizing, not for me, but for the world at large. I'm sure that's still the case.
Now, let me ask you a question which there's simply, I don't imagine any way you can answer.
Uh-huh.
Who do you think, if someone killed him, who do you think was responsible for his killing?
I don't have the answer to that. All I do know is that John was very wary of intelligence services. And let me rewind and tell your listeners and you what the problem was here. The problem wasn't that John didn't file tax returns. That in itself wasn't the problem. Many people don't file tax returns, and many people don't get thrown in Spanish jails for it. The problem was that John didn't file tax returns, but then he went out in the world at conferences while he was running from U.S. authorities and told people that tax was illegal, that they didn't have to pay it, and here's how you do it. Now, that's when it becomes a problem. When you've got a guy like McAfee with 1 million followers on Twitter going out in the world and telling people how to not pay tax, that's when he became a problem. And as far as he told me, that was the issue that the authorities in the U.S. had with him, not specifically that he hadn't filed tax returns. It was the issue that he was basically goading them.
Now, one caller called me the other day, and they asked about a conspiracy theory that's been making the rounds on the internet, that John McAfee might have had something to do with this building that collapsed in Miami, the Surfside condo building. Based on your research, is there any truth to that?
None at all. It's just a conspiracy theory. No truth in it at all. No factual connection whatsoever.
There's also a lot of conspiracy theories involving QAnon. There's a Q Instagram post that sparked a lot of theories regarding something called the Dead Man Switch conspiracy. Briefly, can you explain what that theory is and if there's anything to that?
Yeah, briefly, the DMS, as it's called. John has alluded in the past, to me as well, that if something should happen to him, he has damning information on U.S. government officials and more that would be released automatically online upon his death. Whether that exists or not, we'll have to wait and see. Now, when the Q went up on the Instagram account, what I'm told is that hackers had a look at the code behind the image that formed the Q and found that it led to an Ethereum wallet of some kind. And this is my loose understanding of how this works, with a connection to the WACT tokens, which was the word that John had tattooed on his arm and the word he used for the act of being killed. Now, people put two and two together and thought these two were connected. What I do know is that John never used that Instagram account. John only ever accessed Twitter personally. Now, if someone accessed his Instagram in his close circles or someone who got the password, that's a different thing. But from what I know, I don't know the significance of that cue, but obviously whoever put it there was doing it to stir this kind of conspiracy theory up.
Mark, we're going to have to end it there. I want to wish you the best of luck with your book. Obviously, I think there's going to be, for better or worse, a resurgence in interest in John McAfee's life and in his death. And people may want to check out the book, No Domain, The McAfee Tapes. We've been talking with its author, Mark Eglinton. Mark, I hope we can talk again soon.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Frank. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. Coming up next hour, there is a boatload of stuff I want to get to. We do do the AC report on, what day is today? Thursday. We'll talk a little bit about AC. We'll talk a little bit about the this new show William Shatner has on RT. And there is an invisible addiction that a lot of people are struggling with. I'm not talking about heroin, not talking about opioids. I'm talking about caffeine, namely in the form of coffee. Well, if you are looking for a way to have more energy without caffeine, you really need to think about Life Change Tea. It's great. I drink this stuff every day. It is an herbal proprietary formula that gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. Not only does it taste great and is very refreshing, it's a cold tea. It's got no fillers, no GMOs. It's completely organic, but it's a mild cleanse. It really helps your digestive system do what it's supposed to do. It gets the job done. If you've ever had a tough time being regular, then this will help you move things along, if you know what I mean. So go to the website, getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. You can read some of the testimonials, and you can take a look at a lot of the great supplements that they're selling on there. And whatever you're buying on there, whether it's the tea, whether it's the coral sea, whether it's the pine bark extract, whether it's the colostrum, anything you buy on there, if you use the promo code Frank, you'll get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. So go to GetTheTea.com and use the promo code Frank. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank. Next hour, the AC report. A little bit later, Noel Ashman will stop by. We'll talk about movies, tourism, nightlife, COVID conspiracy theories, a whole bunch of other stuff. And we'll discuss this story that shows a lot of you are addicted to caffeine. Excuse me while I go pour myself another cup. 800-848-9222. Any subject is fair game. In the meantime, keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
A serious issue. I was with Doc Gooden last night at the Cyclones game, courtesy of the invitation from John and Margot Katsimatidis. Thank you again. It's great to be out there and reconnect with a lot of my former colleagues and friends. And Doc Gooden has had problems with substance abuse. A lot of people have. Big problem all over the country. Now, when we think of addiction, we generally think of drugs, alcohol. Sometimes we think of things that aren't chemical, that we don't put in our body but could be addictive, or at least are treated as if they're addictive. Gambling comes to mind. Sex addiction comes to mind, and other things. Fascinating, fascinating piece in The Guardian. And I'm going to link to it on my Facebook page, and I want to encourage you to read it at facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. The invisible addiction. Is it time to give up caffeine? And it's an interesting article by Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-A-N. And he writes, caffeine makes us more energetic, efficient, and faster. But we've become so dependent that we need it just to get to our baseline. And this is something that I've spent a lot of time researching. This is something that I've spent a lot of time talking with Carol Alt about over the years. This is something I've spent a lot of time talking with Dr. Douglas Howard, who's the guy that invented the supplement Balance of Nature. And Michael Pollan writes, after years of starting the day with a tall morning coffee followed by several glasses of green tea at intervals and the occasional cappuccino after lunch, I quit cold turkey. He says, I quit caffeine cold turkey. It was not something that I particularly wanted to do, but I had come to the reluctant conclusion that the story I was writing demanded it. Several of the experts I was interviewing had suggested that I really couldn't understand the role of caffeine in my life, its invisible yet pervasive power, without getting off it and then presumably getting back on. Roland Griffiths, one of the world's leading researchers of mood-altering drugs and the man most responsible for getting the diagnosis of caffeine withdrawal included in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5, which is the Bible of psychiatric diagnoses, told Michael Pollan that he hadn't begun to understand his own relationship with caffeine until he stopped using it and conducted a series of self-experiments. And then he urged this writer to do the same. And Pollan goes on to write about his experience giving up caffeine. And he says, for most of us, to be caffeinated to one degree or another has simply become baseline human consciousness. Something like 90% of humans ingest caffeine regularly, making it the most widely used psychoactive drug in the world and the only one we routinely give to children. Few of us even think of it as a drug, much less our daily use of it as an addiction. It's so pervasive that it's easy to overlook the fact that to be caffeinated is not baseline consciousness, but in fact, an altered state. It just happens to be a state that virtually all of us share, rendering it invisible. And that's really the sentence in this story that blew my mind. It reminded me of the book Brave New World, which I believe is Aldous Huxley. And everyone, and it takes place in the future. It's kind of a futuristic dystopia. And everyone in the future in this book is on drugs. They're on this drug called Soma. Everyone's on it. So nobody notices that that everyone else is acting a little strange. And that's what Michael Pollan writes about our caffeinated state. Caffeine is a drug. I'm drinking a cup of coffee right now. That's not a sound effect. I'm drinking a cup of coffee right now. And a lot of the people, especially a lot of the people that work this time of night, have come to rely upon caffeine. Now, it's interesting. I did give up caffeine, basically cold turkey. And then I went without any coffee or any caffeine at all for months. And then I would switch to one a week and two a week. Now I'm back on caffeine every day. I did not notice any profound effects when I gave up caffeine. But reading this article again has led me to think that maybe I should go back to giving up caffeine. I do like caffeine. Especially I love coffee. I love the way it smells. I love the rituals involved in coffee. But I've been thinking, hey, maybe it's not the best thing for me to be in this permanent state, this permanent altered state. So the scientists have spelled out, and Michael Pollan notes in this article, the predictable symptoms of caffeine withdrawal: headache, fatigue, lethargy, difficulty concentrating, decreased motivation, irritability, intense distress, loss of confidence, and dysphoria. But beneath that deceptively mild rubric of difficulty concentrating hides nothing short of an existential threat to the work of the writer. How can you possibly expect to write anything when you can't concentrate? See, I'll be honest with you. I never really experienced that stuff. I kind of just missed drinking coffee and being able to stay awake for the ride home. And that's really what leads me to not want to give up coffee, is for fear of falling asleep while driving. You have a cup of coffee or two and you're in pretty good shape. So this article is fascinating. And he talks about how over the course of, after a few days of giving up caffeine, he He began to feel better. The veil lifted, but he says he was not quite himself, and neither was the world. In this new normal, the world seemed duller to him. He seemed duller, too. Mornings were the worst. He came to see how integral caffeine was to the daily work of knitting ourselves back together after the fraying of consciousness during sleep. And he writes that humanity's acquaintance with caffeine is not something that has been with us since the days of the cavemen, but it's surprisingly recent. It's hardly an exaggeration to say that this molecule remade the world. The changes wrought by coffee and tea occurred at a fundamental level, the level of the human mind. Coffee and tea ushered in a shift in the mental weather, sharpening minds that had been fogged by alcohol, freeing people from the natural rhythms of the body and the sun, thus making possible whole new kinds of work and arguably new kinds of thought, too. By the 15th century, coffee was being cultivated in East Africa and traded across the Arabian Peninsula. Initially, the new drink was regarded as an aid to concentration and was used by people in Yemen to keep them from dozing off during their religious observances. Tea, too, started out as a little helper for Buddhist monks striving to stay awake through long stretches of meditation. Within a century, coffee houses had sprung up in cities across the Arab world. In 1570, there were more than 600 of them in Constantinople alone. Istanbul, not Constantinople. Istanbul, Constantinople. And they spread north and west with the Ottoman Empire. The Islamic world at this time was in many respects more advanced than Europe in science and technology and in learning. Whether this mental flourishing had anything to do with the prevalence of coffee and the prohibition of alcohol, obviously, is difficult to prove. But then he cites a German historian which makes a pretty good case that coffee was responsible for this. So it's a lengthy article, but it's an interesting one. And the writer writes, here's what I was missing. I missed the way caffeine and its rituals used to order my day, especially in the morning. Herbal teas, which are barely, if at all, psychoactive, lack the power of coffee and tea to organize the day into a rhythm of energetic peaks and valleys. That was kind of my view. At some point, I began to wonder, and again, it's not me speaking, it's Michael Pollan, if perhaps it was all in my head, this sense that I had lost a mental step since getting off coffee and tea. So I decided to look at the science to learn what, if any, cognitive enhancement can actually be attributed to caffeine. And he found numerous studies conducted over the years reporting that caffeine improves performance on a range of cognitive measures: memory, focus, alertness, vigilance, attention, learning. An experiment done in the 30s found that chess players on caffeine perform significantly better than players who abstain. So then the question becomes is, look, I know I'm in a permanently altered state by being on caffeine all the time, but it's like the baseball player who chooses not to take steroids or performance-enhancing drugs, and everybody else playing is on performance-enhancing drugs. Doesn't he put himself at a disadvantage? If the whole rest of the world is taking this performance-enhancing drug of caffeine, and I'm not, don't I put myself at a disadvantage? So I'd be curious if you found that caffeine is addictive. 800-848-9222. Have you ever tried to give up caffeine? Did you experience these severe withdrawal symptoms? And the writer writes, how exactly does coffee and caffeine more generally make us more energetic, efficient, and faster? How could this little molecule possibly supply the human body energy without calories? Could caffeine be the proverbial free lunch? Or do we pay a price for the mental and physical energy, the alertness, the focus, and the stamina that caffeine gives us? And he writes, alas, there is no free lunch. It turns out that caffeine only appears to give us energy. Caffeine works by blocking the action of adenosine, which is a molecule that gradually accumulates in the brain over the course of the day, preparing the body to rest. So caffeine molecules interfere with this process. They keep adenosine from doing its job and keep us feeling alert. But adenosine levels continue to rise so that when the caffeine is eventually metabolized, the adenosine floods the body's receptors and tiredness returns. So the energy that caffeine gives us is borrowed, in effect. And eventually the debt must be paid back. For as long as people have been drinking coffee and tea, medical authorities have warned about the dangers of caffeine. But until now, caffeine's been cleared of most of the serious charges against it. The current scientific consensus is more than reassuring. In fact, the research suggests that coffee and tea actually offer some important benefits. So this writer's review of the medical literature on coffee and tea made him wonder if his abstention might be compromising not only his mental function, but his physical health. But that was before he spoke with Matt Walker, an English neuroscientist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the book Why We Sleep, which I've actually read. It's a great book. I tried to get Matthew Walker on the show, but I guess because he's writing books about sleep, he doesn't want to stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning to do interviews. Okay. Walker grew up in England drinking copious amounts of black tea, morning, noon, and night. He no longer consumes caffeine except for small amounts in his occasional cup of decaf. In fact, none of the sleep researchers or experts that this writer interviewed for this story use caffeine. Walker explained that for most people, the quarter life of caffeine is usually about 12 hours, meaning that 25% of the caffeine in a cup of coffee consumed at noon is still circulating in your brain when you go to bed at midnight. That could well be enough to completely wreck your deep sleep. So the writer thought of himself as a pretty good sleeper before he met Mr. Walker. At lunch, he asked him about his sleeping habits. He told him, "I usually get a solid 7 hours." And then caffeine is not, apparently the whole country is dealing with problems with sleep and getting REM sleep and deep sleep. And caffeine is not the sole cause of the sleep crisis. Screens, whether it's computer screens or cell phones, which I have to be honest, I think I'm looking at a screen pretty much the whole day. The whole day. I'm looking at one screen or another, including right now. Alcohol, which is as hard on REM sleep as caffeine is on deep sleep, pharmaceuticals, work schedules, noise and light pollution, and anxiety can all play a role in undermining both the duration and the quality of sleep. But here's what's insidious about caffeine. The drug is not only a leading cause of our sleep deprivation, it's also the principal tool we rely on to remedy the problem. Most of the caffeine consumed today is being used to compensate for the lousy sleep that caffeine causes, which means that caffeine is helping to hide from our awareness the very problem that caffeine creates. You know, it's funny, Jerry Seinfeld in his stand-up act does a bit about this, about how maybe the reason we can't sleep is because we're consuming these giant cups of coffee. So I thought this was a pretty interesting article. And if you want to read it, I have linked to it, facebook.com/MoranoFan. It's an edited extract from This Is Your Mind on Plants, Opium, Caffeine, Mescaline, which is a book that's just out this week. Your thoughts, your comments, 800-848-WABC. Al is in Manhattan. Hello, Al.
Hey, Mr. Rano. How you doing?
Great.
Yeah, as far as coffee, you know, it's always back and forth. It's good, it's bad, it's good or bad. Here's what I've known over the years. It comes from like 60 different plants, about 1,100 different compounds. So you got to figure that some of those are probably good, some not so good, especially in excess, especially affecting the heart. But long term, they can tell you about 10 items right off the bat that are great. You burn fat more, okay? Your chances of getting Parkinson's, much lower.
You're right about that, actually. You're absolutely right. And my uncle Carmine, who had Parkinson's, rarely had a cup of coffee.
Really? And Alzheimer's is very important. See, well, your good problem is you're in a sleep-deprived business. See, what the body craves, what people fail to realize is this. 300 years ago, other than a gas light or something. When the sun went down, guess what? That was the visual cue for your body to say, after about a half an hour, damn, I'm tired. Well, because you worked out in the fields or doing this and that. You did not wake up until, guess what? As the sun is coming up, the bird sense it half an hour before we do. You're supposed to get up at dawn. Nobody does that anymore. And your body takes 8 hours during that time of sleep to go into REM, this and that. And it's not so much for the physical part of working. It's the mental. In the last seventh or eighth hour is when we knit our memories. So you're, what you're doing is actually, because I've done night work for years, it's very bad for us in the future because we have no way of the brain saying the 50,000 things that happen in a typical day are all boring. But your mind, in order to remember something that was unusual, you might have gone to AC and you did real good. You want to remember that. Guess what? It has to have the sleep to put it in that filing cabinet for later. So that's why I'm saying with coffee, it sounds counterintuitive. There's a lot of things. Liver cancer, guess what? People that drink a lot get what's called fatty liver. That's a precursor for getting liver cancer. And liver cancer is no joke because it's connected to the stomach and the pancreas. So when one of those three together are there, it's usually sayonara time. I hate to say it, sadly. But anyway, I think overall, and what's more pleasurable than coffee? You know what I mean?
Exactly. Honestly. Exactly.
Within minutes, it's a calming effect. And when you need a lot of it, it can get you home over that Verizon.
That is
Listen,
for sure,
take care,
Mark.
And thanks for your great shows, as always.
Thank you, Al. Very kind. Thanks for such a thoughtful call. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. If reading this article, and again, I do hope you read it, Facebook.com/MoranoFan, because I didn't even scratch the surface of everything that's in it. But if reading this article leads you to think, hey, maybe I want to try to go without caffeine for a week or two. Well, how am I going to get energy without caffeine? A great way to do it is with Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea is herbal. It's powerful, it does give you more energy, and it does do it without any caffeine. It also tastes pretty good. It's completely natural, it's completely organic. It also helps you aid in digestion. It helps you detox. It helps you get the toxins that are in your body, helps you get them out of your body. And that's one of the reasons they call it the tea that makes you go. It makes you go in terms of energy, and it also makes you go to the bathroom. Go to the website getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you use the promo code Frank when you order, you'll get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Rumors spreading into battle. I see movements and the clearing. Someone sent you something satanic.
Elton John singing I've Seen the Saucers. If this isn't a song about UFOs or UAPs, I don't know what is. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We'll do the AC report in a few minutes. I got a lot of great feedback from people at the game, at the Cyclones game yesterday, that listened to the show regularly and said, I haven't even been to Atlantic City in 10 years, but in listening to your segments, I feel like I know what's going on. So I was glad to hear that. You always wonder about certain segments that, whether it's professional wrestling, UFOs, Atlantic City, whatever, baseball, that people may not necessarily have an interest in it. Are they going to stick with it? And based on the anecdotal feedback I got from the game yesterday, and quite frankly, based on the ratings that we're seeing, I guess people are listening to that. 800-848-9222. Pedro is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Pedro.
Good morning, Frank.
Good morrow.
Regarding coffee, when I retired 2 years ago from the job, I've had maybe two cups of coffee, and that's it. I don't miss it. But I grew up with coffee. You know, when I was a little kid, you know, I had my cafe con leche that mm-hmm. my mom would give mm-hmm. me when I was 4 years old. And then when I was in college in the 70s, I would have like 7 to 8 cups of coffee a day. And I will take it straight black. No milk, no sugar.
Well, that's what I do. Like that's what I do, too.
All right. But like I said, when I retired 2 years ago, you know, I had 2 cups of coffee in these 2 years, and I don't miss it at all.
Well, so that aside from missing it, Pedro, how do you feel? Do you feel any different from the hyper-caffeinated way that you felt when you were drinking 7 or 8 cups a day?
Not exactly. At the moment when I was working, yes, okay, I needed a little extra boost. But since I'm not doing as much anymore, I don't need that boost.
Interesting. Well, I appreciate the perspective, Pedro. Thank you. We're going to talk with David Pena. He is the owner of Boogie Nights, which I think is actually reopening today in Atlantic City. So we'll talk with him about how things are over there. I have some other thoughts about my recent trip there as well. Mike is in West Palm Beach. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Frank. Top of the morning. You had a caller, a few callers back, who was right on target with the coffee. But before I start that, my perspective, did you play in the game last night at Cyclones?
I didn't play. I just watched.
Okay. I know you worked for them 20 years ago.
That's true.
The present head coach is Ed Blankmeyer, the most winning coach in St. John's history.
Oh.
My old coach was St. John's Hall of Fame, and I met Ed at New York Tech, coach's old school. Huh. But anyway, yeah, my perspective on coffee. I don't drink a lot of coffee now. I just woke up before. Sometimes my sleep cycle is off. If I don't take a nap or whatever, I get up early. I just had a cup of coffee before. But working overnight, especially, you know, I like my sports and talk radio. There was a guy, he does a national show now. I said, JJ, how many cups of coffee do you have on the overnight shift? Oh, Mike, and he's, you know, I got like 10 cups. I said, that's too much, bro. He's like in his, you know, late 20s. But it could really alter you for the rest of your days, especially like you mentioned, Frank. If you're mixing pharmaceuticals, forget it. That's a different scenario right there. But I'll leave you with this. Proud to be father pretty soon, and that's why I tune you in, Frank. You got it going on.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that very much. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. Do read this. Read this article, because I'm not even doing it justice with the amount of research and information that's in it. Facebook.com/MoranoFan. Click like while you're there. Read the article, and I think you're going to find it pretty interesting. Mike is in Manhattan. Hello, Mike.
Well, I retired. You know, I was disabled and retired. And just like your previous caller, I decided I didn't need coffee anymore. So I've given it up for like 2 years.
And how have you felt over the last 2 years?
Well, first, you know, it was a headache for 2 months. It was like, I didn't think this headache would ever go away. Because
wow.
I realized, talk about an addiction. I was addicted to coffee. And that I had withdrawal symptoms that lasted like 2 months. But since then, I've been okay. I've replaced with just drinking like mineral water, you know, kind of thing. But I was drinking, I mean, talk about 8 cups or 10 cups. That's amateur out of me. I was drinking like 15 cups a day. And
wow.
And I switched to like Red Bull. And oh. I was literally drinking a gallon of that, 60 ounces of it a day. And it's like, I realized like my blood pressure was going up as well. It's going up to like 145 over 95.
Have you noticed since you gave it up 2 years ago, have you noticed a difference in the quality, the length, or the depth of your sleep?
Well, you should mention that the dreams become very very intense. You know, kind of really deep focus, intense dreams that seem like reality, to the point where, like, I was dreaming last night, I was reading a book and I could actually read the words on the
huh.
book in sleep. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was like really intense. Would be like imaginative dreams that have been amazingly like almost to a frightening level. And I realized what it is that I'm not destroying my sleep cycle with the REM sleep.
Interesting.
I realized that.
Interesting. Well, that's interesting, Mike. I think you might have actually inspired me. I think I may do next week. I may try next week caffeine free. and just see how it goes. I went 5 months without any caffeine at all, and I was just fine. And I was not working these hours, that's for sure. I just kind of got in the habit then one cup a week, then one a day, then two a day. Now I'm drinking 4 or 5 cups a day. And you read this article, and you know, it's funny, years ago, and then we'll get to the AC report in a second. Years ago, when I first started working with Curtis Sliwa, we had a conversation about drinking alcohol. And I asked him, you know, because his mother's side of the family is Italian. And, you know, Italian families really love their wine. And we were out to lunch or something one day. And I asked him, well, how come you don't drink? And there was a brief period of time where Curtis did drink. But I said, how come you don't drink? And he basically said, well, I decided a long time ago that I really just didn't like being impaired. And I thought that was such an interesting thing to say. Not interesting enough for me to go without alcohol. But in reading this article, it really does make you realize that we're all hooked on this drug of caffeine. And it does alter our sensibility. It doesn't give us more energy. It doesn't actually make us more alert. It actually just fools our brain into thinking we are more alert. But if everybody else is hypercaffeinated, does it make sense to unilaterally disarm? I don't know. Hey, we'll do the AC report next. David Pena from Boogie Nights will join me. We'll chat about all things Atlantic City. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead. Frank Morano,
77 WABC. This is the AC report.
Chicken man in Philly last night, and they blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble on the promenade, and the gambling commissioner's hanging on by the skin of his teeth. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies, someday he comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
There's not a city in the world like Atlantic City. It is a small town and an international city at the same time. It is a place that has a unique combination of beach, gaming, nightlife, restaurants, and it's got its fair share of problems. It is an incredible place. It's one of my favorite places to visit. And I enjoy spending a couple of minutes a week talking about it. Lo and behold, I'm reading Chuck Darrow's article in Better's Insider. And he headline, Casino File, Boogie Nights to Reopen at Trop. And then it goes on to say, Boogie Nights owner promises July 15th reopening will include surprises, along with the heaping helpings of baby boomer and Gen X nostalgia that are the nightclub's calling card. So I thought, well, hey, wait a minute. David Pena, the owner of Boogie Nights, listens to this show from time to time. Let's see if we can get him to call in and see what some of these surprises actually are. Lo and behold, he was kind enough to do just that. David, how are you? Thanks so much for joining me on the radio this morning.
Frank, thanks so much for having me on. Greetings from Atlantic City, New Jersey. I'm super excited about tomorrow night's opening of Boogie Nights.
All right, so
tonight's opening of Boogie Nights.
So if people haven't been to Atlantic City in a while, or if they go there and they tend to play slots or play the tables, what exactly is Boogie Nights?
All right, so Boogie Nights, for people that don't know, Boogie Nights is the ultimate 70s, 80s, and 90s nightclub. And we've been around since 2007. We originally opened at Resorts Casino in Atlantic City. And in 2012, we created this entire utopia of nostalgia and an incredible, just imagine Studio 54 meets Disneyland. And I'm originally from New York, so hello to all my New Yorkers out there that are listening. We invite you to Boogie Nights in Atlantic City at Tropicana Casino. Boogie Nights is really an interactive experience, a dance club that's, you know, not just your regular nightclub. We have a visual component to it, audio components. Basically, so just imagine, we have a big jumbotron showing a lot of nostalgic videos from the past, not just the music videos, but we also like to incorporate everything great from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, because that really was a great landscape. And it was probably the most decadent times, the most visual times for fashion, music. You know, MTV came out at that time when they actually played music videos. And so we try to incorporate that, but at the same time, we have interactive characters, the roller girl that you might know from the, you know, obviously the movie Boogie Nights, but we have Mr. Boogie, Mirror Man. We try to create this interactive experience so the customers, everywhere they go, they actually have some sort of, you know, excitement, and they're able to take photos. And I mean, we really pride ourselves on, the fact is, most nightclubs only last 2 years. We've been around since 2007.
Yeah,
we are so grateful because we have the loyal following, and we have it from New York, definitely. We have it from New Jersey and Philadelphia and other places around the country, because I have clubs around the country. But this is so exciting. You know, Atlantic City is coming back. I mean, you know, we had a tough year last year, but I can feel the energy coming back. Everybody can sense it. Everybody feels it. Everybody's talking about it. You know, the boardwalk's getting busy. The beaches are getting busy. The casinos are packed. But it was the nightlife that was really missing, because we really did. We were the last in line to get approved. So once they gave the green light, we were ready to rock. And so I'm bringing in the original crew. I'm adding new characters to the mix. Everybody's super excited about this weekend. We kick off tomorrow night at 9 o'clock at Tropicana.
Chuck Darrow writes opening line in his piece about your reopening. There's no doubt David Pena would be a billionaire if only he could figure out how to bottle and market the joy he's currently feeling. And it's funny, listening to you talk, he's exactly right. I could tell how enthusiastic and energetic you are. Now, David, I'm going to be joined by Noel Ashman, I don't know if you know Noel, but he's like a New York nightlife guy and has been for a long time. He's going to be here at 4:30. Last time he was here, the question I asked him is, why are all these nightclubs so loud? Let me ask you about Boogie Nights. For people that haven't been there, am I going to be able to go there? Yeah. Are you guys loud, or can I have a conversation there?
No, let me just tell you. So we break it up into certain – that's why we have a few different compartments of Boogie Nights. We have a lot of space there. It's high ceilings. But one of the things is, I'd never wanted to be considered like an oldies party or a retro party or anything like that. I always wanted to make it I would always tell the sound engineers, make it like a Motorhead concert, but disco and pop and rock. And that's the thing about Boogie Nights is we're not a disco. We play disco music. You know, Casey and the Sunshine Band shows up all the time at the club. We have a lot of celebrities that come in. Dan Aykroyd, Tiffany is one of my great friends. But the thing is, yes, the room for me needs to be loud. And I'm one of the only idiots that doesn't wear earplugs in my ears.
Oh.
And, yeah. And all my sound people, everybody's wearing earplugs. And I'm like, you know, but how do you know what the customer hears then? You know, and so I always make sure I don't wear earplugs, which is not a good thing.
No.
But it's not necessarily loud. And so what I do is I have a breakout room and areas in the club where you can actually go and talk. So it's the bar is where you need to be heard.
Now, let's say
the dance floor is where you need to feel the bass hit you in the chest.
So let's say, you know, my co-anchor at 5 a.m., Juliet Huddy, she's a dancer. And I think this is her type of music. I think she would like this. Let's say you're
why
like
don't you guys come down.
Well, we want to. You got to invite us down to do the show. We'll do the show from there. It'll be fun. I'm not much of a dancer. Will people like me that aren't much of a dancer but may like this kind of music, will they feel at home at Boogie Nights?
Absolutely. I mean, here's the great things. We also have a Boogie Nights party pit, for which is a gaming area where people can play table games.
Right, oh, outside. Cool.
So if you want to as you walk in, if you're on, if there's a long line, or if you just want to just take a break from dancing, you can go play a game outside at the Boogie Nights table games, but inside as well. I mean, what we do is we turn the music format, the music formula every 10 minutes. The basic Boogie Nights formula is every 10 minutes, we change the formula. So it could be 10 minutes of rock, 10 minutes of pop, 10 minutes of R&B, 10 minutes of hip hop, 10 minutes of old school disco. And we just make sure that everybody, every demographic is being hit. And I think that's the magic in the formula of Boogie Nights, is that you get somebody from who's celebrating their 21st birthday with all their family in a VIP booth and popping bottles. And that's a great thing to see. Like, it's very rare to see like a family sitting at a table together.
That's for sure.
And the truth is, New York really gave me the landscape of how Boogie Nights should be formatted. I took everything I learned from New York, Limelight, Webster Hall, CBGB's, Danceteria, every place I ever went to in New York City, I tried to mix it all up and make it happen. And as a matter of fact, when you go to Boogie Nights, you'll see nostalgia from New York. You'll see the graffiti subway trains on the video screen. You'll see Evel Knievel jumping off the, making the jump, Muhammad Ali, Wonder Woman, all these things. We just want to give it like overstimulation. It's like, for me, I was too young to go to Studio 54 back in the day, but I went to all the other clubs. And I took everything I learned from all the other clubs, mixed it all up, and over-exaggerated it. And that's what Boogie Nights Atlantic City is at Tropicana.
Talking with David Pena, he is the owner of Boogie Nights, which is at the Tropicana, reopening tonight. It's going to be open Thursday through Saturdays. What are the hours going to be generally, David?
So we pop the doors at 9 o'clock, and it's every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Tropicana Atlantic City. We actually opened last week in Indiana, and it was so packed, which gave me so much courage and inspiration to open, this week. Because, anytime you open something, you're always nervous that nobody's going to show up, and you're like, oh, will they show up? People are so excited to be there, and I couldn't be happier. We have the most loyal, customers and fans, and we appreciate everything. And I want to invite all you New Yorkers to come out.
Outstanding. Now, you also own Planet Rose, which is a terrific karaoke bar where my performance of Hey Jealous Lover from 3 years ago is still being talked about. Although I did have to pay
a
cover.
Atlantic City or New York?
Oh, no, in Atlantic City. Atlantic City.
Okay, because our original was in New York.
Next time I go as my performance fee, I'm going to try and get you to waive the cover charge. I tried to negotiate with the bouncer by throwing your name around.
You don't pay cover charge anymore in Atlantic City.
Wonderful, thank you. I'm going to bring the audio recording of that. Now, David, I'm always trying to get people down to Atlantic City. I love Atlantic City, not only for great places like yours, the great restaurants, the places to play, the boardwalk, the beach. But I do hear from, people that are a little concerned. One of the areas, a caller brought this up yesterday, one of the areas that I have heard some concern is about crime and people being concerned about being able to walk the boardwalk in an environment, without being accosted or assaulted.
Right.
As far as you're concerned, from what you're observed, just speaking honestly with the two of us, is crime a problem in Atlantic City? Should people feel safe walking around there?
On the boardwalk, yes. And, to be absolutely honest, I mean, I've been coming to Atlantic City when I was a kid with my parents in the 80s. So it's kind of similar to the 80s, but I think things are getting a lot better. I think the more the volume comes back as far as like business, it creates more awareness of everything. And like any city, I grew up in New York, so I know what crime's like. And, I've also been to Atlantic City, and that's a different type of thing. And I would say that, it's one of the things that we definitely need to address for sure. And what? I think they are addressing it, and they need to address it quickly. But there's always been that element. When anytime you're in any, major city, whether it's Vegas or Atlantic City, it's always going to be, people that hang around and try to, you know, piggyback off of ice.
That's true. All right, David, best of luck tonight. I'm looking forward to being down there. Unless you invite us down to do the show sooner than rather than later, I'm planning to be down there again in August, and I'll definitely pop in and play this recording of that I don't have to pay a cover charge at Planet Rose.
So. you don't have to pay a cover charge. You're my guest in Atlantic City.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm going to just tell people I'm on the list.
And I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Check out Boogie Nights. It's at the Tropicana. It's a great property that plays some great music. David Pena is a great guy that has done a lot for Atlantic City. I will say, I didn't mention this the other day, but on Saturday, my wife and I are walking the boardwalk. And we had a great time. You know, she's with child. So we're walking around. We had beautiful weather, having a couple of drinks. I smoked a cigar as I was walking along the boardwalk. And I was glad I was with my wife, because when I'm walking, I get so in my own head. I just get lost in my thoughts, and I get lost in my cigar and my – I think I was drinking a whiskey. And I just – I don't really notice anything that's going on around me. And my wife says to me, oh, look at that. Go over there. Go over there and help him. And so I look to the right, and I see a gentleman who's in a motorized wheelchair. And he's stuck. He's stuck in the sand. And I couldn't tell whether he was trying to get onto the beach from the boardwalk or come back to the boardwalk from the beach. And I think he was trying to go to the beach, but he got stuck. He couldn't move. And you see his wheels just literally spinning in the sand. He couldn't move. He was at a standstill. And it was really hot. And you could see he's pouring sweat down his face. And you could see, I don't know what particular ailment this gentleman had, if it was ALS or muscular dystrophy or cerebral palsy or something like that. But he really couldn't communicate very well, and he didn't seem to have great function of his hands and his body. But obviously, once my wife pointed this out to me and I saw that he was stuck, I went right over there. I have no idea how long he was stuck. But I try to ask him, are you trying to go onto the beach or come off? And he really just couldn't respond. And I pulled him out, and he then wheeled onto the boardwalk. And then whenever you see somebody who has a disability like that, the first thing you think, especially I as a soon-to-be father, the first thing you think is, you know, you hope your child is healthy and doesn't have to deal with those kind of struggles like that. But the other thing my wife said to me, and her words have stuck with me for the last 4 days, and it really struck an emotional chord with me. She said, you know, that, and he thanked me, the guy. He was able to verbalize the words, thank you. And then he sped off. But I could see the guy almost crying and sweating profusely as he was stuck on the beach. And the thing that struck me about what my wife said is she said the words, the poor guy, all he wanted to do was go to the beach. And I thought, how sad that is that she's probably right. He probably just wanted to go to the beach just like everybody else. And he just got stuck. And I'm actually going to write a letter to the CRDA and to some other people that I know down there in Atlantic City, because they really should have some handicap accessible way to get from the boardwalk to the beach. Maybe they do, but I didn't see it. And you would think this fellow would have known about it, because how many other people similarly situated probably can't go onto the beach because they're going to get stuck in the sand as they're driving their motorized wheelchair on there. So her comments really did inspire me to try and do something about getting beach access. I know Jesse Kurtz, a councilman there. George Tibbett is a councilman who's been on this show. The mayor's been on this show. And I'm going to send them all a letter letting them know, and along with the CRDA, who has a lot of juice down there, letting them know that I really do think there should be some way for people who are in wheelchairs, especially people that are almost totally immobile, as this gentleman was, to get onto the beach and just enjoy it. I mean, they're not going to be able to go for a swim or go surfing like a lot of people are. But if they just want to sit on the beach and just take it in for a couple of minutes, there's no reason that they should have to deal with getting stuck in the sand. So and I know we have a lot of Atlantic City people that listen to this show. I hope you'll bring that message to the powers that be down there as well and let them know. 800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side Midnight. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Side of Midnight. You know, a lot of people in the Facebook group, and I would encourage you to join the Facebook group if you listen to the show. Just go on Facebook, type Morano Radio Fans and Haters. They say this song gets stuck in their head all day long. I totally relate. It's from the Swan Silvertones, and I first heard this song when Curtis Sliwa was doing this shift. He was doing, I think, 2 a.m. to 6:30 a.m., and I said at the time, and this is close to 30 years ago, I said at the time that if I ever host an overnight show, I would play that song to start my last hour. And sure enough, I have had that opportunity and have that opportunity currently. And I definitely think it was as appropriate a song in 2021 as it was in 1990. I guess it was back to 1995 because it was after Curtis was let go. And then they brought him back to do overnights. That's when he was doing this. Maybe 94, but whatever the case may be. So a lot of you I know listen to the show. You have different hours, odd hours, whatever. And I appreciate that, believe me. But it's sort of a different audience a lot of the time that listens to the 77 WABC Early News with Juliet Huddy and me. So Juliet does these great Jet Set Juliet travel updates. It's around 5:40, right after my 5:40 business update. And she profiles different places. She has different themes. And it's really something. I've learned a lot about travel in listening to these segments. And so on – what's today? Thursday? On Tuesday, she did a whole segment about traveling alone. And she did a follow-up to it yesterday. And then sure enough, Joe Nolan, the traffic guy, talked about his experience traveling alone by train. And it got me thinking, I've never been on vacation really by myself. I mean, I've traveled different places by myself. I've gone to Washington by myself. But usually I'm going there for something and I'll meet up with people down there that I know. I mean, that's the thing is I tend to, you know, I know people in a lot of different cities. So whether I'm going to Albany, Washington, I went to Seattle by myself, but that was a business trip. You know, I don't really feel like I'm vacationing by myself. And I'll never forget the words of my friend George, who was on the show one time, George Fontes. He's a big Politico now. But I knew him when he was nobody, right? He wasn't nobody. He was somebody. But he had just gotten back from Europe. And he traveled to Europe by himself. And he said, you know, Frank, if I could give you one piece of advice, if you go to Europe, go by yourself because it forces you to make friends. And now until I went to Italy with 30 or 40 listeners, plus my mom and Joe Piscopo in October of 2019, I had not been back to Europe since I had that conversation with George. But listening to Jet Set Juliet's travel report and Joe Nolan's commentary and listening to the feedback from listeners over the course of the last couple of days has got me thinking that maybe going on vacation by yourself, traveling solo, does have its benefits. So I'd be curious to hear from you. Have you ever taken a vacation by yourself? And when I say a vacation, I mean a legit vacation. You go somewhere, whether it's by train, plane, or automobile. You stay somewhere, and you are solo. And what was that experience like for you? Because I don't think I've ever really done it. I've, again, gone to different functions by myself, business trips, political trips, whatever. But I don't think I've ever taken a vacation by myself. And I don't know that I ever will now. Because if, you know, what do you get? A couple of weeks of vacation a year. My wife gets a couple of weeks. And if we're going to do something, if we're going to spend the money to go on vacation, we're probably going to spend it together so that we can share that memory together. But I know some couples do go on separate vacations. I'd be curious what your impression has been if you've ever traveled by yourself. Give me a call. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. And then Noel Ashman is going to be here at the bottom of the hour, and we'll chat about a wide variety of subjects. I saw his friend Bo Deedle at the game yesterday at the Cyclones, and Bo was nice. Bo was very gracious. He said hello and everything. So it's all cool. All cool as far as I'm concerned anyway. 800-848-WABC. And we're also on Twitter at Frank Morano. That's Frank Morano. I will tell you, it was so great to be back in Coney Island at the ballpark that I worked at 20 years ago. And I was there for the we had basically WABC day there, and Margot Katsimatidis threw out the first pitch, and it was really nice. But I got to reconnect I'm in touch with them. But it was the first time that I'd seen at the same time Steve Cohen, the general manager, and Gary Perrone. I'm not sure what Gary's official title is now. But I'll tell you, Gary runs stuff over there. And not that John Katsimatidis is going to solicit my input, but if I was giving him advice on who to hire as the general manager of this new Staten Island baseball team that he's buying, it would absolutely be Gary Perrone. And it was great to see Gary and Steve, and we reminisced a little bit about old times, and we caught up. And there's two great stories that I'm always reminded of with both of them. And maybe you've heard me tell the story. But so Gary was the community relations manager in the Cyclones' inaugural season 20 years ago. And, you know, you sing the national anthem before every game. And Gary – oh, by the way, Constantine Maroulis sang the national anthem last night. The guy was phenomenal. It was great. I'd never heard him sing before. He was great. Absolutely great. So and I enjoyed his show last Saturday as well. It was quite good. Saturday's 5 p.m. right before Cousin Brucey. So 20 years ago, Gary is the community relations manager, one of the top guys in the organization at the Brooklyn Cyclones. And the national anthem singer gets sick all of a sudden. And what happens? There's no national anthem singer. Then we had a program, basically a program that would play audio. It was called Click Effects. It breaks. So we can't play the national anthem. So Gary says, Gary, who's a bit of a showman, Gary says, well, what if I were to go and sing it? And now, we can't believe what we're hearing. Those of us – I worked in the video production department with my friend Vic Christopher and a bunch of others. We can't believe Gary's seriously suggesting this. But we're completely egging him on. Yeah, Gary, go ahead. Go ahead. Go sing it. And he does a practice run of singing the national anthem, not Mike, just for us in the production booth. And he does a good job. Lo and behold, Gary decides he's going to sing the national anthem. And he sings it. And it's a total and complete disaster. A total disaster. He actually has to stop in the middle of the song and apologize during the national anthem. I mean, imagine. He's singing the national anthem and he's saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And then he starts again. It was very funny, But it was not – it was a little embarrassing for Gary. But Gary, he took it in good humor. And then when we went to karaoke the following Friday, which was one of the things we used to do back then when we'd go out after the games, Gary, as his karaoke selection, started singing the national anthem. But that was funny. Steve Cohen, who was then and now the general manager of the Cyclones, there were these three executives, R.C., Kevin. This is the 2002 season. R.C., Kevin, and Steve Cohen, the general manager, they would get together every night in one of the suites, same kind of suite that the Catsimatidis had when we all went yesterday. They would get together every night in one of the suites and have a beer after the game and just sit, the three of them, and talk. And lo and behold, there was a ball, a foul ball, that was hit into the parking lot in the eighth or ninth inning of the game. After the game, I go out into the parking lot. I'm ready to leave. And then I see the whole staff gathered around one car. I say, "Hey, Billy, what's going on here?" "Well, look." "Oh," I said, "wow, a foul ball broke someone's windshield?" And they said, "No, that's not somebody's windshield. That's Steve Cohen's windshield." Imagine that. The general manager of the team had his windshield smashed by a foul ball. Now, you know me, the mischievous streak that I have in me. I said, "Oh, nobody tell Steve. I know where he is right now. I'm going to go tell him." Now, I don't know what it is about youthful exuberance that made me think this was a good idea for me to be the run to run and tell the boss in front of his colleagues that his car just got smashed. But whatever, I have that mischievous streak. So I go up to the suite that I know that he's drinking in with his colleagues. And I do my whole big, long introduction. You know, you've seen me introduce a guest. You've heard me introduce a topic. There's a lot of show involved. And I said, "Steve, you know those foul balls that are always hit out of play?" "Yes." "Well, you know how a lot of times we don't really wonder what happens to these foul balls? And you realize we have this parking lot filled with cars right beside us. And then you ever wonder, do these foul balls ever hit cars?" And Steve says to me, he's annoyed now because I've taken so long to get to the point. He says, "All right, Frank, I don't have time for this." He says, "What's the story? Did your car get hit with a foul ball? Because if it did, we're not paying for it." And I said, "Steve, no, my car's just fine. Your windshield, however, is completely smashed." And then he just bows his head and buries it in his hands while his two colleagues start laughing hysterically. So I'm always reminded of that story, of both of those stories, whenever I see either Steve or Gary. And to have the opportunity to see both of them in the same night as I did yesterday was a reminder of a lot of those good times in Coney Island. 800-848-WABC. Curious, have you ever traveled by yourself on a vacation, and what was that experience like? 1-800-848-WABC. Mel is in Tom's River. Hey, Mel.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Great show.
Thank you.
I went to Club Med by myself in March of 2001 to the Turks and Caicos. It was amazing. I had a really good time.
Now, why did you choose to go by yourself?
Well, I was in a relationship. I was, but we were having issues. It was stalled and stuff. And I went without him. I went without him. He was pretty pissed off too.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah, but I didn't care. I didn't care. We were like on the precipice of getting engaged. We were supposed to get engaged, and I kept pushing for it. I'll never push for something like that again. So I just decided that I was gonna get away. I was gonna go on vacation, and I did.
You know, it's funny. I saw the movie recently, or I watched a few minutes of it. It was on television. The film "Forgetting Sarah Marshall," and in that film, for people that haven't seen it, one of the characters has recently been dumped by his girlfriend, and he decides to go to a Hawaii. Hawaiian resort by himself. And it seemed like it was kind of a sad experience for him because all these other couples were around him on their honeymoon, having a good time, going out to dinner together, and he's going to dinner by himself. He's sitting at the bar by himself. He's sitting on the beach by himself. I'm wondering, what was it like for you? Were you around all of these other couples doing couple things while you were sitting there solo?
No. I told your call screener, this particular Club Med, you know, they have all different ones. There's ones that are geared towards families. There's others that are geared towards couples, but there's a few that are geared towards singles, and Turks and Caicos is one of the best.
Interesting.
It was nothing but singles. There weren't any couples there, and a certain age bracket too. At that time, I was in my 30s, so it was mostly people in their, you know, in their 30s. Some a little bit older, but mostly people in their 30s.
Did you find, as my friend George did when he went to Europe solo, that being by yourself, especially in a place that was catering to singles, led you to make more friends than you otherwise would have?
Yes. Because at Club Med, you get a roommate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. At Club Med, I mean, you can get, it'll cost more, but you can get a room by yourself. But, you know, it's like $500 extra. So it's like, you know, you kiss your hand up to God and hope you have a really great roommate. And she was great.
Oh, that's wonderful. And then, needless to say, you broke up with the fella that you were seeing.
How did you know that, Frank? Yes, I did.
Call it a lucky guess.
Frank, how did you know that? Are you psychic?
I must be.
Can you do a reading for me?
Well, hopefully you found another nice fella. You sound like a nice lady.
No, actually.
No, you're not a nice lady?
Yes, I am a nice lady, but I am single.
Oh, all right. Well, Christian's single, too. Do you want me to, you know, put you guys together at all?
Well, the thing is that how old is he? Because I'm going to be 56 years old.
I know, but you're a very young sounding 56. And I'll be honest, I don't think a woman hits her sort of peak of sensuality and sexuality until her 50s. So Christian might be a little younger, but I think you guys might be peaking at the same time. I'll leave it up to you. You think about
Frank,
it.
Frank, you're adorable.
Well, thank you.
You know that? You really are. Yeah, I have to tell you, you are like steeped in like a well of adorableness.
Well,
you really are. I don't know. You know, whatever it is that you know, maybe it should be bottled and sold on the open market, Frank. I don't know.
Mel,
there's just something very adorable about you. I don't know what it is.
You're very kind. Yep. Just like I'm going to take David Pena's commentary on not paying cover charges to his bouncer, I'm going to take your endorsement of my adorableness to my wife when she yells at me for something later.
I mean, hey, you know, it's okay. She sounds like a lovely.
And
congratulations on your impending babyhood, fatherhood.
Thank you.
You know?
Thank you very much.
I think you're going to make a great father. You're going to make a great father. You're very kind. You're very loving. And you're adorable.
Well, so I appreciate
any child born to you is going to be very lucky.
Well, that's very, very sweet of you, Mel. Now, I did see that the former mayor of Toms River died recently. How are you and how is the town doing with the former mayor's passing? Are you guys doing okay?
I everybody's just kind of like doing this post-pandemic thing, Frank, to be honest with
Interesting.
You. It's a little strange down here. I'm not originally from down here. I'm from North Jersey. And I moved down here 6 years ago, so it's really weird down here.
Huh?
You know, to me, in my opinion, the politics down here, because they just Citarelli, he's going up against Phil Murphy or something like that. I've kind of like tried to turn my head off to politics.
Sure.
And whatnot, because I've been so disappointed in what has transpired in the last 9 months.
Yeah, no, I totally get it.
You know, without going into it, we all know what it is, and it's just, I don't know, it's weird down here.
Well, I get it. All right, Mel, thank you for the call. I hope you'll call again.
Yes, I will, Frank. Thanks.
Thanks for the feedback. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. You're not interested in Mel.
Well, I was going to say, Frank, I think she's more interested in – A, well, there's two things. A, she sounds like she's more interested in you than she is in me, Frank,
well,
to
that's
be honest.
The thing. That's the thing is, like, you're my radio wingman in this instance. It's like when you go out if you have a girlfriend or a wife, but you bring a single friend and, you know, then all the women, they still come – or men, if the genders are reversed. The women will come to the guy with the girlfriend, and then you pivot them. You foist them on the other guy.
Also, too
– So I'm foisting –
Well,
no,
I appreciate
you.
No, I appreciate the effort too. I was going to say is if you ask Jonathan O'Halloran, who call screens for the morning show, I'm apparently not single anymore.
Oh, you're not?
I'm not on the market.
Is that true?
It's not true. But Jonathan has been up my. He's been making some jokes because I spent the weekend with a friend of mine who is a female friend.
Interesting.
The whole weekend.
So. I was unaware of this. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to try
no,
and
no,
set
there's
you
nothing
up
there.
With Mel.
There's nothing
when,
there. There's nothing
when
there.
You
there's
already
nothing
have
to report.
Something else going on.
All
right.
There's nothing to report.
800-848-WABC. We'll continue with your calls in just a bit. Noel Ashman is going to be here. Always love talking to him. He's a good friend and somebody that has a lot of insight and a lot of experience into everything. And he's just somebody that knows everybody. I told you last time he was here, Rita Cosby said to me as she was leaving, she says, oh, Noel Ashman, you're having Noel Ashman? Oh, I know Noel. He's a friend of mine. Then I go on Facebook and I start promoting that he's going to be on. And then Jeff Smith, the photographer, comments, oh, I know Noel Ashman forever. And I'm going to ask Noel when he gets here. I don't know how he's managed to cultivate this many relationships with people. I mean, I try and cultivate a lot of relationships, but I don't know half the people Noel does. Those of you that are holding, we will get to you in mere moments. But I do want you to do yourself a favor. If you are suffering from chronic pain of any sort, call Trinity Rehab. They have something there called the EPAP machine, which is an FDA-approved non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing. It gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for all sorts of conditions related to chronic pain. Tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, whatever your chronic pain issue is. In just 3 5-minute sessions with the EPAP machine, you could be virtually pain-free. They have convenient locations all over New Jersey. Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, and Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab today at 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. Or go to trinity-rehab.com.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
They got the beat, the Coney Island beat. They got the beat, the Coney Island beat. On the Cyclone Coaster, they were rocking in the seats. And down at Nathan's, they were dancing to the beat. There's a parachute ride, the beaches and the sand. When you're at Luna Park, there is a rocking band. The radio is buzzing and the music's hot. Now everybody jump on the Island Rock.
This song is called Coney Island Beat by Freddie Cannon, and this might be the new anthem of Coney Island. If you want to vote, you can go to WABCradio.com. There's two great songs. It's Coney Island by Vinnie Meduño and Coney Island Beat by Freddie Cannon. And these are songs commissioned by our owner, John Catsimatidis. Remember, I put out a call looking for Coney Island songs a while ago, and I wanted to remember. I should have asked Gary when I saw him at the game yesterday. I wanted to remember that song that we played at every game, which was sort of a novelty Coney Island song, but we've not able to find it. So John commissioned this contest, and that's one of the two finalists. So you can hear both songs, Coney Island Beat by Freddie Cannon and It's Coney Island by Vinnie Madugno on WABCRadio.com, and you can pick the song that you think best represents Coney Island, because it's a lot of things, a lot of fun things happening in Coney Island. I see so many similarities between Coney Island and Atlantic City. That's the God's honest truth. They actually, and they have a lot of the same shared history, the boardwalk, the incubators on the boardwalk invented by Dr. Coney. A lot of that same character, the guy that's the face of Coney Island. If you look at some of the history of Atlantic City, he's in a lot of the old boardwalk stuff down there too. So 800-848-9222, talking a little bit about solo traveling. Let me say hello to Pete in Hackensack. Hello, Pete.
Frank, what's happening over there?
You tell me, Pete.
Well, I'm heading out on a solo trip at the end of July. Going to do a little hiking, a little camping, a little swimming, a little spiritual renewal, so to speak. And my buddy from Atlanta couldn't make it up. We were going to do a little Appalachian Trail hiking. So I'm going to be doing a little solo extravaganza. And it's going to be interesting because I have a fear of bears. So I'm looking to get some bear spray and a few other things that hopefully, you know, confronting my fears will overcome, so to speak.
Well, I certainly hope so. Now, have you traveled before by yourself?
Not really.
Okay. So this is a new experience for you as well.
Yeah. I mean, out in the woods, I mean, I'm going to be, you know, kind of close enough to the car where if I have to, I can run back to the car. And it'll be good. I'm going rain or shine, rain or shine.
Well, that is awesome, Pete. You got to send me a postcard and you've got to call us and let us know how this trip goes and how your experience dealing with the bears is and how your experience traveling solo is.
Yeah. And I'm an older guy. I'll be 61 next month. And
That's not old, Pete.
Okay. I appreciate the Bob Grants where you say straight ahead. That was from Bob. And, you know, The Other Side of Midnight, that was a book.
You know that? I do, and a film. And I wish I could take credit for the title. The title was from our owner, John Catsimatidis. But recently, I saw an interview that Mike Tyson did with Michael Kay. This is going back about 10, 15 years. And he said, Mike Tyson said that his favorite movie is The Other Side of Midnight. Right. So I got to see that film. I've not seen it, but I will check it out. Pete, have a good trip, and I appreciate you calling in.
Absolutely, Frank. God bless, buddy.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. It's 1-800-848-WABC. So Juliet and I were both on vacation. She was in Italy. I was in Cape May. And I think there was one day where we overlapped. And the one day where we overlapped, where we were both off, it happened to be the day that all of the on-air talent was taking photographs. So, they're very accommodating. They said, all right, well, no big deal. If you can't make it, we'll take photos when you're back. So Friday is the day that Juliet and I are going to take photos together and separately. And then the problem here is when I was in Cape May, I, you know, put on weight. So I'm still about 10 or 11 pounds heavier now than I was before I left for Cape May. Now, I will take this off, but it's going to take me a couple of weeks to take it. That's why you really, whether you're traveling solo on vacation or going with other people, my dad always used to warn me about this. You can't go crazy on vacation in terms of eating because you do gain weight quickly. And I didn't think I was going crazy, but you know what it is? It's just not being careful. That's what makes you put the weight on. So, when I got the word yesterday that we were not going to, that we were going to take photos Friday, I said, you know, I don't want to look this morbidly obese in all these photos that we're taking on Friday. So I am going to try not to eat anything between whatever day, Wednesday and Friday. So this way I'll at least look slim. No booze, no food. This way I'll at least look slim for Friday. I'll fool the camera. And lo and behold, I got here and I was so proud of myself at the game. Everyone's eating hot dogs and French fries and all the great food that they had there. They had fresh vegetables and nice dips and everything. I'm not eating anything. Nothing. Everyone's got beers and wine. Everyone's having a time. I'm not touching a drop of it. And then I get here, sure enough, and I'm starving. I'm starving. I start devouring junk food in the kitchen. I get a handful of M&Ms and one of those Kind bars, which if you're not familiar with the Kind bar, it's basically a food designed to look like and make you think you're eating health food when you're in actuality eating a candy bar. So sure enough, my streak went out the window. So I'm going to try and be super careful today. And then come Friday morning at 7 a.m., I'll break my fast after we take these photos. But we'll see how these photos look. See, it kind of cuts both ways because these photos will probably be around for a while, hopefully years. And when you take photos when you're heavy and then you're slimmer, a lot of times people say, oh, you're so much slimmer than your photo. But then do you really necessarily want to constantly be reminded of you being heavy in this photograph? So we'll see. Maybe if I lose a whole bunch of weight, then they can take a new photograph. But that's the story as it stands now. 800-848-WABC. We'll continue with your calls in just a moment. Noel Ashman will be here. But one of the key elements in my taking off this Cape May weight is life change tea, because you drink this life change tea and it doesn't linger in your stomach. It helps you detoxify and pass all the food that you're eating. It also gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. If you haven't tried life change tea yet, I hope you will. You can go to the website getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you order some of the tea or any of the other supplements on there and you use the promo code Frank, you will get to enjoy a significant discount. Precisely, you will get to enjoy free shipping. GetTheTea.com is the website. Life Change Tea is the product. Promo code is Frank.
Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
You know, it's funny when Russell from White Plains called the other day. I'm kind of a William Shatner expert. I'm almost a William Shatner groupie. And when Russell from White Plains called the other day saying that William Shatner had launched a new show on RT, I was surprised because that was the first that I'd heard of it. And I thought I was up on all the latest Shatner news. And sure enough, he's right. And I haven't seen this show yet, and I will see it. But Shatner he did launch a new show this week on RT America, the American branch of RT, which has been dubbed an arm of the Kremlin's propaganda machine by U.S. intelligence and some other people around the world. And this is one of the many reasons I love William Shatner at 90 years old, because he does not care. He went on Twitter and he defended himself and talked, and he went straight about how he doesn't owe anybody explanation. He said, look, they have nothing to do with the content. We're making this show. We're producing it. They have nothing to do with the guests, the editing, or anything else. They're just airing it. So I didn't think I could like William Shatner any more than I do. But sure enough, he has managed, with his full-throated defense of doing whatever he wants to do, he has managed to make me like him even more. There was one issue because an RT executive said that Captain Kirk has gone over to the good side, and Shatner apparently didn't like that, and he fired off at her. Now, I am also thrilled to welcome one of my favorite people, Noel Ashman, the man who seems to know everybody, film producer, entrepreneur, and legendary nightlife impresario. Noel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, most important question. Did you – you drove here? Or
cab.
You cabbed here?
Cab
okay.
Here.
But you were in a vehicle.
In here. A vehicle.
Did you listen to the show on the way here?
I did not, actually. I
was well, what the heck were you listening
the
to?
The FDR was shut up down, so I couldn't get down.
Was
the
it really?
So I had to go all the way around. Yeah, it was
oh, man.
Fun.
Yeah, I noticed when I was leaving yesterday morning, I was trying to take the FDR. The FDR was shut as I was leaving, going southbound.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll see. Hopefully we have an easier time, both of us,
they
going
better
home
open
today.
In the morning.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So how are you?
Great.
It's good to see you. You're looking well.
Good to see you, too.
All right. Now, you have a great deal of experience in the nightlife sector. We've chronicled some of your heroics running legendary bars and nightclubs like Veruca, which is, I think, where I first met you 20 years ago.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, there's so much focus on tourism in New York. And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about how important nightlife is to the tourism formula? Do people come to cities like New York in the hopes of, you know, going to clubs and bars and things like that?
Absolutely. I think nightlife is one of the most important things for tourism in New York City because that's what it's, you know, New York is known as the nightlife capital of the world. And I think that it's been a real problem if you don't have great nightlife in New York. I mean, I think that's what people come here for.
Yeah. I mean, that's been my experience. Now, the other thing that we – that's been part of the conversation when it comes to tourism is the crime issue. Based – and you live here. You work here. Based on what you've produced films here, based on what you're seeing, how significant is the crime problem in New York?
It's the worst I've seen it in since I was a kid probably. I think it's real serious. I mean, I think when you're letting people out of you get rid of bail and you just let everybody out to the cops arrest, that's going to cause an immediate problem. I don't think we're at the point we were back in the 80s, but I think it will get there if they don't do something very quickly.
Yeah, we're talking with Noel Ashman. You can learn more about him at noelashman.com. He's a film producer, an entrepreneur, and a nightlife impresario. We were talking a little bit about the mayor's race. Last time you were here, you kind of gave your evaluation of both candidates. Both candidates, the Republican Curtis Lee with the Democrat Eric Adams, do seem to be pretty heavily focused on the issue of crime politically. Do you think that's wise?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's why Eric Adams clearly won. I think that he was the only one talking about it on the Democratic side, which is crazy to me. But, yeah, no, I think crime is going to drive – I think not just this election, the mayor election, but I think the
governor's race next year?
The governor's race, and I think even nationally. You
really?
Know, the congressional in 22. Yeah, I really do. I think that people are fed up with it. I really do.
I think you're right, and I hope you're right. And it's going to be interesting to see how that manifests itself in the mayor's race. Speaking of crime, I ran into your friend, the longtime hero cop and crime fighter himself, Bo Deedle, at the Cyclones game in Coney Island last night. We were both out there for Margot Katsimatidis throwing out the first pitch.
Ah.
I was curious. You know, I know you and Bo were pretty tight. How did you get to know Bo initially?
Well, it's funny. Bo was very close friends with my father. They both grew up together in Queens. But it wasn't until a little bit later in my life that we got, you know, very close. When I started doing clubs, my father was always so against it. Like, what are you doing? Nightclubs, you know.
What line of business was your father in?
My dad was by profession a dentist, but he invented something called HCR, heart tissue replacement, which is a synthetic bone they use for nose jobs, all types of stuff for teeth and all kinds of stuff now. So he hated it. But he's like, if you're going to do it, you got to talk to Bo. And then I started talking to Bo, and he's been a partner in every club I've ever done. And, you know, he's been with me the whole way.
Really?
And he's been, yeah, Bo's really been a second father to me. He's been,
you're kidding.
Oh, no, really. He wow. absolutely has. He's been wow. completely like a second father to
That's
me.
That's terrific.
In every way. You know, he's a guy I call for anything. He's always there. He's one of the best people I know.
Wow. Well, that's a ringing endorsement. Now, you've been involved in a lot of businesses here in New York City. New York City, especially lately, has not had the best reputation in terms of being a business-friendly community. Your experience running businesses here, do you think New York's a tough place to run a business in?
It is, and it's one of the stupidest things about New York. I can tell you, you know, running any kind of small business, with, I mean, I've ran clubs, bars, restaurants, et cetera. But anything, whether you're a corner deli, I mean, you get harassed for the stupidest things in New York. You get taxed up the wazoo. And it's ridiculous, frankly. I mean, we need to be bringing anyone who wants to open a business in New York, we should support. Everyone should support. We should love small businesses in New York.
Agreed.
And I think that it's for some reason a lot of our leaders don't see it that way. They see businesses as like a piggy bank that you could just keep taxing. And that's not the way it should be looked at.
No doubt.
Businesses
about it.
Are what, you know, employs our state. And our city, I think that it's the most important thing we have, a small business.
Mm. Last hour, we had the I know you hang out once in a while at the Tropicana in Atlantic City. We had the owner of Boogie Nights at the Trop call in. They're reopening tonight after being closed for more than the past year. If you were opening a club these days, whether you're reopening as Boogie Nights is or you're starting from scratch in the current climate, the concerns about COVID, concerned places like both New York and Atlantic City and probably most cities in this country, what would be the most important thing for a club owner to keep in mind?
If you're opening a new space, I think it's having reserve capital because one thing this whole pandemic has shown us is anything can happen. And I think it's very important to have reserve capital for anything that could happen. I'm actually looking at spaces now. I've been looking a little bit to potentially open something, but it would be a very small type of thing. I don't want to do a big club or anything. But I just think New York really needs it right now.
One of the things that seems a little bit different in the post-pandemic world is that some people are not coming back to work. Some people are – my wife, for instance, she's permanently working from home. Some other businesses are doing 2 days home, 3 days in the office. Is New York going to have a tougher time recovering and getting back to its former self if people are not coming to work on a daily basis?
Absolutely, because I think it affects everybody, you know, from your hot dog vendors on the street to you know, restaurants in Midtown. Everything depends on each other. It depends on people going out and living life. And if everyone's home, staying home, it definitely hurts the economy in general.
We have on Sunday afternoons right here on this radio station, Cindy Adams does a show. And I caught her column 2 or 3 weeks ago, and she was talking about one of your films, Fortress 2, and the filming that you had in Puerto Rico. What was that experience like for you guys in Puerto Rico filming Fortress 2?
It was crazy, actually, because while we were filming, all the power went out. They had some big explosion at one of their power plants, and all the power went out in the middle of the movie. We were lucky we had reserve power, and it got through. But a lot of the actors who were saying, you know, we had a lot of people in that movie, like Bruce Willis and Natalie Ura and Jesse Metcalf and a whole bunch, Chad Michael Murray and Shannon Doherty, a bunch of them. And they were all in the hotel. Their power was going on and off. So I don't know. Might not be as fun for them, but we got through it. Luckily.
Well, what's Bruce Willis like on a personal level?
I don't know him real well, but he's always been very cool, very down to earth. I've always found him. I remember back years ago when I was a kid. This is when I was probably 16 years old. He used to come into the old China Club and a lot of places I would hang out at back then, and he would bartend. He would just go behind the bar and bartend. And I think he did a Veruca once where he bartended with Mark Wahlberg, if I'm not mistaken. It was quite funny. He's very down to earth. He's a very cool dude.
I can imagine. Cindy Adams, even though she's 90, she seems as spry and energetic and as with it as anybody that I know. When I've seen her around here, she's pretty energetic. How do you get along with Cindy Adams?
I love Cindy. She's a legend. I mean, she's done it forever. I mean, you got to have nothing but respect for someone like that.
That is absolutely for sure.
She's like a New York staple. She's like exactly what I love about New York.
Right.
You know, people like Cindy.
Only in New York, kids, right?
Exactly.
Only in New York.
The tagline.
One of the things that we've seen some businesses and even some public health experts, and we've talked about COVID last time you were here. You had COVID, and you are of the belief that I think is becoming the increasing consensus that this originated in a lab somehow. But
absolutely.
One of the things that we've heard from some businesses, from some public health experts, is the idea of either mandatory vaccination or needing to show proof of vaccination for certain activities. Bruce Springsteen, for instance, he's demanding, I think, proof of vaccination to go see his concert on Broadway.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that as a business owner, as a guy that's been a club owner, as a guy that's been a film producer, all of which are industries that are toying with this idea of either vaccine requirements or mandatory vaccines? Where do you stand on that?
I'm strongly against it. I think the people – the great thing about living in a free society is we can make our own decisions, whether they be good or bad. We can eat junk food all day. We can eat McDonald's every day if we want. And I think the same thing with the vaccine. I took it. You know, I think I support taking vaccines unless there's some health reason not to, or unless you've had it recently and maybe you don't want to take it for that reason for a certain amount of time. But I think when you try to force people to do something, it has the opposite effect that people don't want to do it. And I think that's a little bit of what we're experiencing right now.
I think you're exactly right.
And I think that – look, if we believe in the vaccines and we believe that they work, which we do, then if you've had your vaccine, why does it matter if the guy next to you has a vaccine? You have it. You're fine. So I don't really understand the logic there. If someone doesn't want to get a vaccine and they get sick, that's on them. You know, no one else – everyone should have the right to be as healthy or unhealthy as they want to be.
We were talking earlier about tipping and the generational differences in tipping. As somebody that's worked in a service industry, the data from this one survey that we talked about earlier showed that millennials and Generation Zers tend to be much worse tippers than anybody else. Has that been your experience?
It's interesting. Yeah, I guess I have seen that a bit. I think there's a little bit of I think the older generations have more of a – I don't want to say respect for the job, but I have noticed that to a point, yes.
And we were joking around last time you were here, and I was mentioning this in the run-up to your appearance, that you seem to know everybody. And one of the many things that I've always admired about you is your ability to cultivate relationships over the years. What's the secret sauce on that, Noel? For people that may find themselves wanting to do a better job networking in their own lives or just for either professional reasons or personal reasons, how have you managed to cultivate so many relationships with so many people over the years?
Well, first of all, thank you. I guess everyone has their own way of doing it. I'm just myself, whether I'm with the most famous person in the world or a busboy, or I'd like to think I'm the same person in any way. I think when you're real with people, people respect that. I don't think I'm particularly cool or flashy or anything. I think I'm just very my me, and you know, either people like me or they don't, but you know, you always know what you're going to get.
Final question, and then you got to come back hopefully soon, and we won't have the FDR closures to deal with. We'll get more time to get into a lot of stuff.
I'd love to.
But Anthony Bourdain, one of the most famous TV personalities of all time, one of the most famous chefs of all time, and one of the most famous travel commentators of all time, you're actually in his book from 2000. I think it was Parts Unknown, right?
Kitchen Confidential.
There's a new documentary about him now. Curious, what were your observations of Anthony Bourdain? What was he like as a person? What were your interactions like with him?
I wasn't close with him, but I knew him over a long period of time. I met him years ago when I was a promoter, when I was a little kid. I was probably 20 at the time, at Supper Club, where he was the chef, and I was doing the parties there. So he always used to come out and say, "Why is it so busy out here? You're the reason again." And then he'd laugh. Very down to earth, very cool guy. Very smart, very intellectual, very interesting. I always had amazing conversations.
Are you going to watch the documentary?
Absolutely.
All right. Noel Ashman, thank you very much for the time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We'll do 15 seconds of fame next. Whatever you want to comment on, we'll give you 15 seconds to do it. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Oh, it's that time of the morning. 15 seconds to say whatever you like. 1-800-848-9222. It's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Ted in Forest Hills, what do you have for us?
Yeah, well, I was in the city across the sea, and then I took a train. 50-hour trip. Where did I wind up? Siberia. So help me God. Take care. God bless you. God is blessed.
Wow. All right. Gary in Staten Island. Hello.
Guantanamera. Wahia. Guantanamera. Guantanamera. Wahia. Guantanamera. Viva Cuba. Revolucionario.
Irishman in the Bronx. Hello.
Read the Janine Machine by Richard Blasberg and TwistedJustice at CNN.com. That's the Janine Machine by Richard Blasberg and TwistedJustice at CNN.com. Janine Pierre is a criminal and a fraud who sent an innocent New York City cop to prison.
Rick in Tom's River. Hello.
Good morning. On this corner, let people know if they want to know what Joe Nolan looks like, because he's been on the radio for many, many, many years. He looks like Beaver Cleaver grown up.
Pete in Randall, Florida. Hello.
Sizzle moron.
And finally, E. Frank in Astoria. Hello, E. Frank.
Yes, Frank.
So wait. Let me say goodbye to Pete. Go ahead, E. Frank.
Yes, it seems like the municipal city charter of the city of New York is in non-operational overload because Curtis Lewa is dead as a doornail at this time.
There you go, E. Frank. Nothing like a little wisdom. All right, the WABC Early News is next with Juliette Huddy, Joel Nolan, Sid Rosenberg, and me. To be continued.